Honorable Yandy, take his advice. Take his advice, the Honorable Mike Pearson. Right. Mike Pearson, the committee business is the tabling of information requested with respect to the colloquium. Now you'll see here, this is simply draft. This is draft one. Please label it draft one. Draft one, whoever's getting that ready. Draft one. So the colloquium, isn't this the draft report? Now let's just get it anyway, because I see the first draft is not here, it was what was on the front. Anyway, that's simply tabled, and we're not going to discuss it as such. We then come back to information requested with respect to the colloquium. And if you've got anything to add after that, because I think that's the important issue in respect of the report itself, then we can go back. So I'll reserve my comments till after you. So tabling of the information in connection with the colloquium, do you want to speak to that, Mr. Hermans?
Chair, we have requested additional information based on the discussions that we had during the colloquium. And we request it from Plastics SA, from Arthur Mitchell, from CIFSA, as well as from SASL. Mm-hmm. We've only received a responses from Arthur Mitchell, CIFSA, and Plastics SA. With regard to SASL, there was some communication or glitches, and eventually received the request for information, additional information, which have not yet submitted to us. So that's the information that members have received, the information that was requested as a result of the discussion during the colloquium.
I've also asked Mr. Hermans. I had the good fortune to deliver a paper at the Science Council, and I say I had the good fortune. I met people far more informed than I was at that seminar, which is often the case. And one of the very good papers delivered there was on value addition in respect of titanium. And when I looked at that value chain, it was quite formidable. And I really think, I really believe that the paper that was given there would be of value to us, because it goes both upstream, downstream, and looking at the various source base. As you move down that stream, not everyone has to be armed with a degree. Certainly in some of the areas you do. But as you move further downstream and so on, and even in the middle, a lot of skills can be employed, a variety. Very much like the sort of automobile industry, where a variety of skills are employed there. And really one would like to add them to the colloquium. Would that be an order? Honorable Mandali?
No, I want to report that because it's very important for the rest of this committee after the committee. But I wanted to raise a very serious concern. I am very concerned about SASL. Mm-hmm. I don't think SASL is taking this committee very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I arrived in a meeting maybe 10 or 15 minutes late, but presenting, I could not engage with them because I did not receive documentation before. When I asked the committee secretary, he told me that the documentation arrived that morning. And that is very disabling for us as a committee. So I would like the committee to stress to us that we need that information in time, because we must prepare. We can't just listen to people and then develop ideas from there. We need time to discuss this matter, and then we can engage them. So I will appeal that we get information as early as possible. Thank you very much.
Yes, Uncle.
Thank you very much, Chair. My request would just be that if we could please see the correspondence. I think it would be useful to table the correspondence here as well, the original letter to those all of those entities, as well as their responses, so that we can also read it and get the information firsthand.
Okay. Yes, now when it comes to correspondence, now I don't intend bringing correspondence here. However, with respect to the questions that were put to them, certainly, okay. So certainly where we said, and just in case we've overlooked one or two questions, which is quite possible, okay. So certainly the questions, Mr. Hermans, need to come to the committee. Did we accommodate everyone's questions there, one? Two, their responses to us. Is that an order then? Right. Okay. Now, the central, this has been an ongoing issue. So let's not say that it's just happened now. For some time now, we've been deeply concerned about the business behavior of SASL. And it has become more alarming with respect to the discounted prices to the polymers in particular, apart from other issues that we may wish to raise. As to say they haven't been forthcoming, I wouldn't agree with that entirely. I think we need to study it. But if you want to say, or if you say that we need more time with them, yes, we do need more time with them. Let's put it the other way around. Because we also ran out of time. You know, when you have shorter time, people skip their answers and responses. So they may also say, we never had enough time. Now let's not say they didn't want to do it. Let's give them more time. Let's do that. All right, so if you look at the schedule after when you return, you will see on Tuesday the 21st, I think. Is it?
The
17th, yeah. We've got the beautiful R and then the colloquium on SASL. We've only got SASL there from, it would be 9.30 to 13.30. That's a long time with minutes. So there'd be no excuse now for them not to explain themselves more effectively. Are we agreed on that? Fine. Okay, let's come back to the NCC. I think that's already been addressed by yourself, and it has been handed out, hasn't it? Haven't you got this information, members? Yes. So that's, and I think you will find that SIP3 is quite effective there, and a few other things. Just before we get into the training, and we make an early start there, we do need to, I thought we have added one more issue there, and that was the correspondence from committee members. Such as Mr. McPherson, programming matter.
Well, but outstanding matter.
Yeah. So I'm saying that those, they're not outstanding. We addressed it last week when we said we would address it in the program. But that's why I want to address it again now, with respect to the program, because you're now consideration of the program. Okay. There are three issues that have come up. I'll deal with the one which is both second and is the very latest information, and that is to do with gambling per se. Now, as indicated, we wanted to get a clear legal position on the mandate of the committee, because as most of you know, gambling, you've come from provinces, some of you, that is a concurrent mandate. Okay. Now, generally we like to leave the provinces to handle these matters. However, the reality is that the National Gambling Board, on the one hand, is very much a national structure. The second thing is the norms and standards are established, and certain other issues with respect to gambling, and the provinces have to comply with that as well. So, generally, my approach has been, in that regard, to ask the FCOP, a sister house, to deal with it. Of course, I want to acknowledge very clearly, legally, it doesn't prevent us dealing with it. I make that clear as well. So that, you can see one isn't fronting the issue. Legally, we can deal with it constitutionally. It has been our practice up to now to try and encourage the NCOP to deal with these issues as they visit the provinces. But having looked at the matter itself, and especially as the National Board, Gambling Board, has also been suspended, as it were, there is a need for us to look at gambling quite urgently. They were scheduled, as you know, here on the 14th of August, in October. Can you see that? But that was actually the annual report. From the annual report, though, I believe that certain things would have been apparent, considering that the annual report went until March. It should have been visible there. The Auditor General's report should make something apparent. So I think you should have been able to discern, or we should be able to discern, some challenges. I don't know what you think, but I think if this thing blew up in May, June, can I put it this way? Surely it's been something that's been sitting, especially a governance issue. Does a governance issue arise overnight? It doesn't. It's there. So the kind of proposal we can suggest is that we look at one or two things during that period. And bearing in mind that that was also a day that we were going to visit the factories, the House of Monastic, at 2 o'clock. So the NRCS could be done quite early, in an hour or so, and the NGB, we then would have 3 hours with them, 2.5 hours. I think that that is sufficient time for us to tackle a few things. I don't think, I don't know who will be giving us the NGB annual report, as there's been a suspension of everyone, and I'm pointing to yourself. But that would be an opportunity to invite the MEC if we so choose. But we need to examine every area. Do you understand? Do you understand?
So we seem to be confusing
two issues. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Well, the NGB and we've got to get it in.
Just put that down, please. I said the one is the NGB. But it may offer us an opportunity on the same day to address another matter related with gambling. We haven't taken a decision. Right, someone had a hand up. Honourable Nkongi?
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Mr. President. You have been saying date, because over the weekend, I understood that it wasn't suspended. And that it is an administrator that has been appointed by the minister from the land. From the department.
Mm.
So that's something in the report that we're going to receive, or the annual report will be tabled by the department. So if we agree, I don't have a problem with that. Mm. We need to call them because it is out of their mind.
Honourable McPherson? There's two issues. Huh? What happened there?
I don't know. There are two issues that I just want honourable members to be aware of. The first one is obviously the dissolving of the KZN Gambling Board that I wrote to you requesting that we call in an MEC, Belinda Cross from KZN, the MEC for Finance, who oversees that particular issue. And I do believe that it is something that warrants our investigation and briefing from the MEC. On what has gone on with that board. And then my second request for information to honourable members was that the minister come and explain his decision to dissolve the National Gambling Board, which he did on the 9th of September, but we were only informed through the media on Monday, it was. And so while we might get a report on the annual performance of the National Gambling Board, my issue is that the minister must come and explain his actions and his inability to communicate to this committee his decision and why it took 2 weeks and what are the circumstances, what is the allegations of that are requiring a forensic investigation. We need to unpack what has led to the minister's decision, and that is a meeting on itself, Chair, I can assure you. And that's why I think that we need to separate the annual report of the Gambling Board. We need to separate the KZN issue, and we need to separate the meeting with the Minister on the National Gambling Board.
Our program doesn't allow us the luxury of extended time. But let me correct one thing. The Minister did inform me as Chair about the suspension of the Board. Unfortunately, We haven't heard that many committee meetings. It's been over this period. And that's why I've raised it now. He did certainly, I got communication from the committee, from the minister in this regard. So he's not obliged to inform the committee. He's obliged to inform the chairperson. And that is important to understand. Yes.
Then, Chair, I put it to you then why we have to find out the committee members through the media that the decision had taken place. And that is my fundamental problem with the way this issue has been handled. And I still believe that we need to unpack it. I think it's a very serious issue that an entity has been placed in under administration. So I don't know where we find the time, but we need to find the time. We cannot have a situation where we as a committee have an entity that is now under administration and we can't discuss it because we don't have time.
Let me make it clear. In your own words, you indicated you heard from the media on Monday. Was it 3 weeks ago or this Monday?
This Monday.
Did we meet Tuesday?
No.
No. When is our first meeting since Monday? When is our first meeting since I was informed? Or would you like me to start calling committee meeting Friday night? I am. Now, I suggest when it comes to things like that, I don't intend communicating by electronic mail. Absolutely not. But at a committee meeting. And I'm not going to debate this, Honourable McPherson, at all. I'm telling you now that communication, I dealt with it in committee as soon as possible. Right. Honourable Congi?
No, thank you very much, President. I think there are things that we need to make them as facts easier. And there are things that we must not make them as norms of our committee meetings. One, I don't think we're going to use this committee to summon ministers. I would like you, Chairperson, to concentrate to summon ministers. You know why I'm raising this thing. The minister of trading industry has been coming since I arrived in this parliament to this committee, having briefing us about activities that are taking place in the department. And the matter of the gambling board and the crisis that was beginning, the minister briefed us about that. And if we can go to our minister since we started, we are going to find this. And that is how I knew about the crisis in the gambling board, was through the interaction of the committee with the minister. Now the minister has taken a decision that has been an issue since this fifth parliament started. So I do not understand what is this, what is this attachment, you know, for the minister to always come to this meeting. If the department which reports to the minister is able to come here and explain that matter, it must be. So I propose before that we call them, and then the administrator are going to inform the committee on the decision of the minister. But if the minister is available at that point in time, therefore, it's going to be a bonus for this committee. So I want us to take off this thing of session, of summoning people as if we are a summon gang.
Thank you, Honourable Mkongi. I know that your hand was first, but I'm taking someone fresh, Honourable Mantash.
It is, I don't know whether I should call it a point of order or not.
No.
But I have a concern about when a member is speaking, another member lifts his hand. Because that distracts the person on the platform. Now, I'm disturbed by what Comrade Honourable Mkongi is doing. Can we wait and then lift our hands and be observed? Not when someone speaks, if that person is out of order.
Yes. Now, I have already indicated to the Honourable McPherson, I would not take him again on this issue because I've heard you sufficiently. In respect of that meeting on Friday, we finished at about 11, half past 11. And on that note, we're going to leave the matter. The Minister did inform me, and I have informed the committee as soon as possible, officially. Secondly, just so that you are aware of... No.
I do need to get a response in writing then to my...
No. Honourable McPherson, this is not the way I'm running this committee, and you know it. I don't run the committee like that. Other chairs may, but I don't. I don't. I give you sufficient time to talk on substantive issues. This is now dealt with. This is a correspondence matter. You have been officially informed of the matter. I mean, for that matter, one wants to digest for a moment the fact that you knew about the WTO before the chair who was invited, then I should be kicking up a shindig. But I don't. No, because that's not a substantive matter. We only deal with substantive matters and allow people extended time zones as much as possible. So what I am saying is I'm trying to alter the program since it was actually prepared and passed. We passed this program, we now have in the committee to make certain changes to it. So that Honourable Crowley signs it off. The proposal I have already made is the NRCS has been reporting to us regularly. And therefore, there's no need to give them 1.5 hours. Do you see that? We're going to give them 1 hour. Then we'll have from 10 o'clock to 1300. That is 3 hours. And that is sufficient time to handle what I want to make appear of gambling issues. That includes the national board. It includes other issues. I also will be inviting the NCOP. This is a provincial matter as well, you know. So I want to invite the NCOP as we are entitled to and allowed by the rules and authorised to be here in a joint committee with us. And, Mr. Hermans will try and work around that one. If it means we have it first to try and accommodate the NCOP, we have it first. If it means we have it later, let's leave those mechanics to the secretary. Can we do that, Mr. Hermans? Can you do that, start expediting that now through Mr. Mkiva? The NEC will also be invited. So we'll deal with a number of those issues, and can we leave it there now, please? Right. Now, that is the 14th. The 15th. And you know you've got these oversight visits now. Monatic. We spent a lot of money on textiles. Let's see what they're up to. And then the SEZ is probably more important than anything, and some of you may know about the opening of the Dubai SEZ. Are you aware of that? We were informed by the minister, but not of a specific date. Now we have been, I believe it's the 6th.
I read it in the media this morning.
Well, may I add, the minister informed us some time ago. So, but I'm glad to see people are, ensuring that the media's coffers are, floating, as it were. Now, that particular one, Dubai, mentioned it from the budget vote. It's the constituency period. This doesn't mean to say that members can't go. Can I see by indication which members would like to go? The 7th of October. Can I see purely from an indication now? Who would like to go? I don't know what day it is, do you? Tuesday, is it? So let's see it again. Honourable Matash, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable McPherson.
I think Honourable Elizabeth
wants to. No, let him speak to himself. I will speak to him, don't worry. He's just stepped out for a minute. All right, let's put those names on. And the 7th is a Tuesday, is it? I'll make myself available as well then. And can you organise, begin processing that subject to approval? See, it takes a week for these things, as you now know, to be approved. Right. We're going to SEZ Kalani Gardens. You know what? SEZ in Valdana and Kalani Gardens, Acacia Pharmaceutical. What are they producing? Is it the syringes? The syringes, yes, Honourable Mkongi.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure what this is. What I'm going to raise, all has the operations of Parliament. I know that we're going to wait for approval, whether it allows for us to go to Dubai, because of the constituency period.
Yeah.
I think maybe there is a confusion about the question of constituents. If tributing that you are given by Parliament, somewhere in the community. Yeah. I think you are doing the job of the committee. We are going to do, but that is our constituency.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the constituency of activity should not be taken as a building that is there in the office. Yeah. There. So whenever we do, when people are going to Monashi, we are going to our constituency, because that is part of our way. So I want that thing to be there when we ask for permission.
Now look, I think that we may need to raise that a certain different political party at the very highest level, because every political party has a different approach, and it's not for me to dictate that. So certainly, we'll ask the whip to, do it from our end. All right. Okay. Fine. But I take your point. The 17th is BRRR, and Cecil, as you see, etc., etc. The only one is the titanium that I've requested you try and factor in. And yeah, so we will factor it in and just leave it there. Can we have someone on that note to approve the program, propose the approval? Honourable Congi, seconded by Honourable Thoughtful. There we are. Thank you. And our training program. Well, thank God we're starting as close as possible to 9:30. And now, the way we do things changes, as you know. It's not a committee meeting anymore, and we're not taking decisions now. So it becomes more flexible, and I also need to indicate that because I got this information about the WTO at 8:15 this morning, I'm required to go and get my Schengen visa updated. So that does require my absence for an hour at some point in time. Right. But let's look at the people who are coming here to be with us today. I think we're all aware of, perhaps we're not, Mr. Nimrod Zulk. Zulk, I think you've been here once before this term, am I correct?
Yes.
Mr. Zulk is, one of the foremost experts in industrialization, so we're very happy he can, share his knowledge with us in South African terms. Thank you very much. Of course, we've got Ambassador Ishmael. I asked Ambassador Ishmael to distribute his book here, and we would buy it. He then informed us there's no longer the sale, and I became alarmed. Until he told me it was free. Now, actually, it's not an email book as such. It's on his website. And he's written 4 or 5 books. One of the books, or several of them, certainly one, has been translated by the Chinese. And it is used from capitalist to socialist countries because I think it's a practitioner's guide. Let me put it that way. I'm sure that's not what you're calling it. But, you know, it helps you to get a better understanding of that WTO animal. And then we have Mr. T. Damana. Thank you very much for being here with us. We don't have quite the same long background. Perhaps you can share with the committee, Mr. Damana, a little bit of your background.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members. I'm the Chief Director in the Department of Academia and Industry. I deal with issues of standards and quality.
Very important, that one, as you know. Right. So I'll start off chairing this workshop. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get on the board from Congo.
So, Chairperson, I just wanted to ask a formal request because some of the tools of trade that were given by Parliament are not reliable. So if the books are free, I request that the committee secretariat to package them for us to give us, because some of us, we want to be students in this part of the field. So it's very
No, we will take that up, and hence my concern was to actually distribute the book itself. Let's leave it there. I'd like to get some takers for this, for chairing. As I said, I'll start off now, and then we've got the linkages, etc., continued.
I'd like someone by a show of hands from the parties to show me where they'd like, you know, to chair. Let's just get a show of hands. Next one, industrial development. At that one, if I'm gone. All right, no one. Right. Is it someone have their hand up?
I'm trying to sort out my passport as well. I have to shoot out at some point. I don't know.
So you're not sure where? Yeah. Okay. So thank you for letting me know. He'll live? Honourable
Yes, I'm sure he will. Yeah. He'll be back.
All right. Technical infrastructure? Right. I'll certainly be back by then, but never mind. International trade goods and services? Honourable Lianga, you mustn't be so shy. Especially sitting there with all your credentials.
Mm.
We need you. Mm. So I'm going to put you on there under, to take over from me under the industrial development and its linkages, all right? And then let's put yourself, Honourable Mkongi, as international trade goods and services. And then Honourable Mantash, if I have to hand over, why don't you take the technical infrastructure? Things like scales and electric, you know, plugs and one thing and another. Very, on the domestic scene as well, and the knocking over of, what did you call them, lamps and flames all over the place. But I'm sure on the labour issue as well, it is very, very important that labourers, also workers, are dealing with safe stuff. So we clear them, and then tomorrow perhaps we'll fact in people are Jordan, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Shivamba, will you be available for an hour tomorrow to chair? Well, look, I put it this way, it's either going to be early in the morning from 9 until about 8, half past 10, or 10 be after half past 11. One item.
Attend to
okay.
The adult committee.
Oh, yes. Okay. Now, well, thanks for letting us know then. All right, let's make a start. So remember, now we're out of the committee, we're in a workshop. Much more relaxed now. All right? So we have first with us here, industrial development and its linkages, that can only be yourself, result.
Thank you very much, Chair and members. The intention here is to try and step back a little bit from, you know, the kind of day-to-day matters that the committee considers, and to try and talk about industrial development and industrial policy, going back to some of the core principles. But I think also brought out by a couple of case studies to make them tangible. So, Chair, of course, if at any point there's a question, obviously, happy to take that. I would suggest that we pause in during the presentation for questions of clarification and take a more substantive towards the end. So let me then commence by starting off with why manufacturing is so important and is considered to be so important in the process of economic development. So first of all, manufacturing is really about the physical transformation of a set of raw materials into value-added products. And the process through which that happens and through which companies, sectors, and countries acquire capabilities in manufacturing really has to do with knowledge and learning. And it's really about learning how to produce and how to produce effectively. And one way to think about this is that even though most, but not all, technology is available, so if one wants to set up a manufacturing plant, you can go out and you can buy the machinery, you can buy the equipment. But that is not going to make you kind of efficient in manufacturing and able to compete in a domestic market or against imports or in export markets, because a tremendous amount of the learning is not written down. You know, you can't acquire the learning by reading the manuals that covers the machinery and equipment. A lot of it is is acquired through the process of producing itself. So to give an example, somebody can, if you want to learn how to drive a car, somebody can give you a manual and say this is how you drive a car, but you will never be able to learn to drive a car unless you actually drive the car. You know, so manufacturing has that kind of character to it. There's a lot of the knowledge embodied in building a competitive manufacturing business is this knowledge that's acquired through getting up production systems, through training, through learning on the job. And the next question, then, I suppose, is, well, you know, why bother? Why, you know, if there are certain economic activities out there which are easier to do, then, you know, why bother with manufacturing? Why is it important for industrial development? And there's a tremendous amount of theory and evidence in all of the literature that manufacturing is terribly important because, arguably more than any other sector, it has a whole lot of linkage effects with the rest of the economy. So it has what are sometimes called backward linkages. In other words, it draws in inputs from sectors such as agriculture and mining, and it transforms those. It also has forward linkages to new sectors, to the ability to diversify, so capability that are learned in producing in one sector can be used to diversify into new forms of manufacturing, and it creates a demand for a whole range of services throughout the economy. And the demand that it creates for services as well as goods is very important in the context of our consideration of our employment challenge in South Africa, because although there is considerable potential to create direct jobs in manufacturing, we also know that since the early 1990s, with the entry of very large and populous countries into the global trading system like India and China and much of the Eastern Bloc, there's been incredible pressure on the more labor-intensive ends of manufacturing, and it's made it much more difficult for other developing countries to create lots of jobs in manufacturing. So, but what is very, very important are also the indirect effects and the job creation effects in manufacturing in generating the income and the value addition and the income within the economy that sustains services activities. And, one issue we can go into in a bit more detail if people want is that, you know, one of the big weaknesses in the South African economy that we're facing is that we have this period of about, you know, since roughly about 2004 in particular, where services was growing very rapidly, and we were creating new jobs in services, but a lot of that was through an increase in household, an unsustainable increase in household debt. And that is necessary is not something that can increase in infinity. So when households, as they now have done, are sitting at levels of 70 to 80% of debt to disposable income, expansion of credit is no longer a viable option to expand the services sector. So you need an expansion of income within the economy, both to create jobs in manufacturing, but also jobs in services. The other very important function that manufacturing plays is that its ability to generate export income. And this is very important because a lot of what happens in the development process, particularly the earlier stages, is countries need to generate export income to be able to import the capital goods and the machinery to go through their industrialization process. So that's why a number of economists, although this is not university accepted, contested, but make the argument that manufacturing is the engine of growth in an economy. And the one way to try and make it tangible, instead of just conceptual, is to look, take a concrete example from the steel value chain.
and start off, let's try to start off at the kind of the most primary activity at the top. The steel value chain involves, in the first instance, mining of iron ore. Depending on the international price of iron ore, it's gone down recently, but let's just say, you know, this was, I mean, this was at a high, these prices are actually at a higher level. You can sell iron ore on the global market for $180 per ton. We sell a lot of it. We export a lot of it unprocessed to Asia. It creates about 0.2 jobs per 1,000 tons of iron ore mined per year. When you move to the next stage, which is steel production, so the iron ore goes into a steel plant that gets combined with a range of other inputs. If you take a kind of representative steel commodity like hot rolled coil, which goes into it goes into fridges and it goes into cars and buildings and so forth, that can sell for about $585 per ton, roughly per year. And in the steel making process, it generates about 0.8 jobs per 1,000 tons process per year. So this is very, very capital intensive. When you move a further step downstream to something like structural steel, so if you see the building being erected, there's an example here, the kind of steel product that goes into, so there's a bit of fabrication and a bit of processing into this structural steel. The product fell in the order of about $3,000 per ton. So there's really a big jump just from going from hot rolled coil to structural steel in the level of value addition. And there's also a significant jump in the number of jobs per 1,000 tons of steel processed per annum. When you take the next step to a much more sophisticated product like some form of machinery, or in South Africa we have a very good example of the, what we call yellow metals. These are these big dump trucks that are produced for the mining construction industry. Then these things sell, the steel embodied in these trucks sell for around $13,700 per ton. So there's an order of magnitude jump in the value addition, and it embodies around 150 jobs per ton of steel processed per year. So this is really the, you know, hopefully in a tangible way, the practical value addition and job creation potential, the direct developmental role that the manufacturing sector plays as it moves into more and more sophisticated activity. If we then step back to some broader historical evidence, one important piece of evidence about the role of manufacturing comes from a report that was commissioned by something called the Growth Commission in 2008, where a range of prominent economists and policymakers pulled together a report, coordinated a report, trying to understand what it did is it said, what are the economies, this commission said, let's identify the economies that since World War II have grown on a fast and sustained basis. And by fast, they meant they've grown their GDP per capita by more than 7% per annum, and by sustained growth, I mean they've done this over a continuous period of 20 years or more. So they identified 13 countries that have meet this criteria of both high and sustained growth since World War II. One of the standout characteristics is that, with the exception of, I think, three economies, these have all been countries that where manufacturing has
the rate of growth of manufacturing has led and has outstripped the rate of growth of other sectors like agriculture and services. So for 10 of those 13, it's manufacturing that has led this rapid growth. When you look at the other three, they are countries that are difficult to replicate because two of them are single commodity exporters, Botswana, which exports diamonds, and Oman, which exports oil, and Hong Kong is essentially an offshore financial center. So the broad picture that comes out of this is that really there are virtually no countries that have attained rapid and sustained growth and high income levels without industrializing, without growing a large and sophisticated manufacturing sector. And in addition to the 10 countries that the Growth Commission identified, I think there are other success stories that are identified. So, for instance, in the chapter that was circulated by Alice Anderson about the rise of the red, other relative success stories she identified are countries like India, Argentina, Chile, Mexico, and Turkey. So this is more widespread than the common belief that it's only the East Asians that can do this. Furthermore, there's a tremendous amount of evidence, particularly from people like Haijun Chang, and there was a paper circulated on whether Africa can successfully industrialize, and he's presented a lot of evidence in his work that no country is successfully industrialized without industrial policy, and that includes the advanced economies like the US. When one goes back in their own history, what this implies is that simply that countries are very unlikely to reach the levels of income of the advanced economies without industrializing, and that they are very unlikely to industrialize without industrial policy. And there's a few reasons why this is the case. You know, why just kind of left to their own will market allocation of resources and market purely, you know, market determined prices not lead to industrialization and high levels of income. So part of the reason lies in past dependence, that the countries will by and large do more of the same, they'll do more of what they've done in the past. And often this means that they can be locked into quite low value adding type of activities, typically in relation to primary sector activities like agriculture and mining, and that the highest levels of profit may not correspond with highest levels of value addition in the economy. So a particular activity could be very profitable. Mm-hmm. So let's say a particular part of mining or particular types of financial sector activity or retailing, but that doesn't mean that it's adding, that there's a lot of value addition, or that it's stimulating, that these activities are stimulating strong linkages to the rest of the economy. And this is therefore why one needs industrial policy as a set of mechanisms to promote structural change. And there are a few broad elements of this. One has got to do with the kind of coordination that is necessary to change the structure of the economy. In order to do so, requires a combination of price and non-price mechanisms and inducements. And this includes the financing and supporting of significant periods of learning and significant periods of acquiring the technological capabilities to be able to compete effectively against more established countries in the same sector. So if one were to kind of really draw out what are the key elements of industrial policy,
I try to boil this down into what I think are four really key elements, plus a fifth, which is the ongoing adaptation. So one really important element as one looks across what has succeeded in a range of countries, and I think you know, and should be apparent from the readings that were circulated, is that first of all, support mechanisms, a whole range of support mechanisms have historically been deployed to support the development of various manufacturing sectors, and these are ranged very widely from import tariffs to subsidies to concessional provision of finance to the use of procurement and a whole range of measures. What has also been very tremendously important is this coordination function that the state plays. In other words, to be able to coordinate and anticipate the kinds of infrastructure that a different industrial structure will require. And what kind of port do we need if we want to export value-added manufactured products as opposed to exporting bulk mineral products? This is, I mean, a very practical, tangible question for South Africa. What kind of skills development systems and institutions do you need? What kind of energy supply do you need? And these things need to be coordinated at an economy-wide kind of level. So there's a need, there's a coordination function of the state. But what is also tremendously important, and I think comes out very nicely in the reading, both of Ellis Anderson and the reading on Asia, is that, that support alone and coordination alone is insufficient if it doesn't come with a lot of pressures for the recipients of industrial financing and industrial support to rapidly learn and upgrade. So part of that lies in a set of conditionalities that are attached to the support mechanism for industrial support, and part of that lies in very actively encouraging competition, both in the domestic market and terribly important in export markets. So, you know, one of the things that comes across is that if you want to, if you want to have a really lead sector in your economy, it's quite dangerous to say you're just going to, you want to put all your eggs in the basket of one firm, because part of the problem is that one firm will not have a domestic competitor or a couple of firms. So it's very important to promote domestic rivalry together with the support. This is not the same as just opening up your markets to imports. It's support with competition as one element, and then a strong push to encourage firms to move as rapidly as possible into export markets, because the ability to export is really a very, very strong determinant of international competitiveness. I mean, you know, firms and sectors can make a lot of excuses about why they're unable to compete in the domestic market, but if they can't make those excuses in the export market, you either can or you can't. So pushing firms towards export competitiveness is a very powerful kind of mechanism of pressure to make sure that they are sustainable and competitive in the long run. And it also is an immensely useful source of information about which sectors are competitive or not. Or which sectors are moving towards international competitiveness or not. So, and then the last element the fifth element is ongoing adaptation. So as much as manufacturing is a process of learning, industrial policy is itself also a process of learning. And in doing these large kind of complex project, what is inevitably going to happen is that there will be some successes, there will be some failures, and the ability to learn from both success and failure and to adapt is another very important characteristic of successful industrial policy. So, what I then wanted to do, Chair, is discuss a case study which I think is of tremendous interest to South Africa for a whole range of reasons. And that is the case of Ethiopia, which actually is making tremendous strides in this area. And I think it's interesting for a number of reasons. One is that I think when people hear about industrial policy, they typically think of South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Malaysia. There's a tremendous amount of Afro-pessimism. This belief that no African country can do this, South Africa can't do it. Certainly Ethiopia, one of the poorest countries in the world, landlocked, has no ports. We all know the history of Ethiopia, civil war, famine. You could hardly think of worse set of conditions, for success. But really, I think of tremendous relevance to South Africa. Somewhat similarly to many developing countries, including South Africa, in the early 1990s, the Ethiopians, they underwent this program of a series of programs of liberalizing their economy, liberalizing capital markets, liberalizing their trade, lowering their tariffs. Part of that included, in the mid-1990s, an IMF structural adjustment program. But from the early 2000s, they became very dissatisfied with the levels of growth and progress that they were seeing in their economy, and they began to mount a more developmental set of policy programs. And they started off with agriculture. So they started off with a big program to support the growth of small-scale agriculture, and rolling out support for agriculture. The next step for them in this broad program was an industrial development strategy, which they formalized around 2003, within the context of what they call an agriculture demand-led industrialization. So they took a look at what does their economy look like, what are the most obvious prospects for them to begin to industrialize, and they said it's got to start with adding value to what's being produced in the agricultural sector, and they focused on value addition. They said they wanted to be export led to earn foreign exchange. Labor intensive, and to be a public-private type of program. And there were two main sectors that they have initially focused on. One is textile and leather together, and they set a very ambitious target of reaching a goal of exporting of textiles and leather, of value-added textiles and leather products of $500 million in each of those sectors by 2010. And here, when they talk about textiles, it's they're broadly in clothing and textiles, and largely clothing. They estimated this would require about $1.6 billion investment. They recognize that they would need to develop a lot more self-sufficiency in fabrics if they were going to grow the clothing sector. They promoted private investment, but there was also direct state investment and joint ventures with state investment in the fabric sector.
In leather, they recognized that they needed to produce quality leather in order to transform that into shoes and belts and so forth. And so one of the critical things that they identified was to upgrade tanneries and finished products. And one of the measures that they used or put in place in order to discourage the unprocessed export of skins and hides was 150% export tax. And in addition, across these two sectors, they put in place a lot of mechanisms to support training and world-class manufacturing. How did they do? It depends how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't come close to their, what was it, $500 million target by 2010. They reached about 8% of their target in leather, 8% of their target in textiles, and 3.7% of their target in 2010. 3.7% of their target of the target in leather. But the textile exports in 2010 were four times the base in 2003. In other words, between 2003 and 2010, they quadrupled their exports. So, you know, perhaps the $500 million target was unrealistic. But they managed to achieve a quadrupling of their textile export base. And in the process, they learned a series of lessons about which were very important and relevant for them to then take into account in the next phase of the adaptation of their program. So they recognized that one of the big constraints was poor logistics, particularly because Ethiopia doesn't have its own port. It has to go through the port of Djibouti. They recognized that they had to that there was a lot more that they needed to do in relation to building up the fabric production base, and also in modernizing their tannery. Second...
Thank you.
There's a second sector, and this was a much more obvious and more immediate success. So, in the 1990s, there were a couple of private investors who recognized and established operations to produce cut flowers and export these to the European Union. The government kind of noticed that this activity was happening and that it represented an opportunity, and they integrated into their industrial policy, and again, they set some ambitious targets. They wanted to reach a target of 1,000 hectares of flower production within 5 years. And in order to support this, they did a lot of things. They provided very concessional access to land for the growing of these cut flowers. They provided long-term credit. One of the really critical things that they did is they obliged Ethiopian Airways to set up dedicated facilities for the storage and the transportation of these cut flowers to the Netherlands. So, and this is, I mean, flowers, one might think, okay, you know, this is agriculture, it's not particularly sophisticated, and this is very sophisticated value chain, because these flowers go to the Netherlands, they cut, you know, they need to arrive fresh for sale, you know, before they start withering, or you know, there's a lot of these sophisticated production and logistics involved in getting these things into Europe, into what is obviously a demanding market in Europe. So by 2008, they've gone from 2 farms to 81 farms, 1,200 hectares under cultivation, created about 50,000 jobs in the sector. The cut flowers became the fourth largest export sector of Ethiopia, and it's the fifth largest exporter to the EU. And one can see some of the progress if we look at, in all of these sectors, if we look at the
you know, the trajectory of their exports. So the most obvious success, as I've indicated, is the cut flowers. So this is the blue line here. You know, it grew literally from nothing in 2004 to about $190 million exports by 2011. And even the so-called failure of the leather and textiles, you know, they went from about $12 million of exports in textiles and clothing to $71 million over this period, and from the, and 10 times what they were exporting in 2005 of leather articles and footwear by 2011. So admittedly, this is also, it's a low base. What is also, I mean, important to emphasize is this is one kind of part of the broader Ethiopian kind of development strategy and better modernization policies that they're putting in place. So they're making very big investments in housing and in associated industries like cement in infrastructure. So, Chair, I think this would be an appropriate point in any event to stop and take discussions and questions.
Yeah. Now, that would be great. Very interesting so far. Honourable Mkongi, I think we can just at the moment, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, President. So, I would like you to explain the red, the raw height and the skins, yeah, in relation to the leather articles and footwear. What is the relationship between them?
Anyone else just want to come and read something? Just a couple of things. The flowers, etc. You mentioned that they it became, well, the airways just had to provide these services for them. But in terms of the transport, as you've just indicated, time is of the essence here with flower production. Now, they must all grow within 10 or 20 kilometres of the airport. They would have grown much further afield, I take it. So it would be useful to know how far the distance was and to the nearest airport. And did the airways, as it were, then establish airfields around the place? And what measures did they put in place here? Because I know quite a bit about flower production, I may say, and that is a critical issue, is the temperature of the water and the distance to that airfield. And no shock when it gets on the plane. Honourable Liyege?
Thank you, the
issue of industrial issue without a policy, it's a real fact. Now, what I would want to understand, in as far as the developed countries where industrialization is actually tough, where would you locate the policy initiation?
Uh-huh.
Where would you locate? Would this be administrative or political or both or vice versa? Mm-hmm. I'm asking this purposes because industrialization is actually the bone of contention when we want to realize a developed state. Then now one gets worried when you think of the rural communities because it's about that the majority of the masses of South Africa are poor. Then when we talk of this and don't locate the initiation of a policy, we will end up concentrating this without practically doing it, and you have put it very clear to say it's not about it being spoken about, but it has to be this. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Yenge. Honourable Shibambu, followed by Honourable Montash.
Thank you, Chair. Because this is a training, I thought that the would probably locate the whole issue of industrial policy in a broad territorial framework of saying that there is a relatively recent interpretation of industrial policy from what I call the heterodox economics.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is where we should have located it to say that. And central to their analysis of what happens is that we have an existing, particularly from the late 80s and early 90s, mm-hmm. with a view that we need free markets to realize industrial expansion. And then Argentine newspaper speaks about Alexander and all those that illustrate that actually all the countries that are industrialized countries mm-hmm. realized industrial expansion through state intervention and protection
yeah.
everywhere. Like, and it gives, mm-hmm. Argentina gives specific illustrations that the U.S. had state-led policies, the U.K., mm-hmm. Belgium, Germany, all those countries. All the countries that have realized mm-hmm. massive industrial expansion were helped by the state centrally. And then the argument gives is that, and when now they are developed, then they say to everyone else that don't utilize the state, leave the free market to, and when they say that they're kicking away the ladder, the book which I think people must have to look into that, yeah. So the when they stand up there, then they kick away the ladder, that no, for you to get here, you don't need what you did, and we got to where we are. But also, again, the central emphasis is that there is no successful industrial expansion program which happened without state assistance and tariffs and protection of certain sectors of the economy. I think that is a philosophical point of view on the platform. So that was able to guide all these issues. I understand the examples that we were using. If they can be accepted that the state should play a central role in the protection of certain industries, that is when we'll be able to move somewhere. And I thought we would have declared a crisis now, after the colloquium industrialization, that there are so many critical sectors in South Africa that do not have any form of protection. Not even, at 0%, where goods and services are just brought into the country, there is no tariff, there is no support of those industries here to create jobs in terms of what should happen. I think that we need to move more concretely from that philosophical point of view that the state will play a role in driving industrial expansion to utilize existing instruments on trade policy and subsidies that should be given to certain sectors. And in the paper which you little bit said, Argentina, can Africa do it? He argues that it's not true that WTO altogether collapses space for industrial expansion. Just even within that framework, we can still set tariffs. But in South Africa, we don't even have tariffs on furniture. On furniture, on every household, though, the 28 million households require furniture. How many jobs can we create on that? It's one of the things that must be looked into that. What sectors do we not have tariffs and how do we put tariffs? And not just put tariffs because it can just increase prices, put tariffs and then support local industrial expansion of those issues. But also the other agreement which deals with state procurement, it can utilize as a critical component of driving industrial policy. But the first assessment that we need to make is that we are moving from a very problematic philosophical point of view, particularly with regards to the bigger politics of NDPs and all those other things. That is kind of problem now, right, that no, let us have free market and all these other things. And if we are able to deal with the economic problem and realize that there are a lot of things that can be done correctly.
Thank you, Honorable Chimambu. Honorable Mantash.
So thank you. I just wanted to understand what Nimrod was saying on why, in that case study, did the raw hygiene scheme not make progress? Because I think that for us, it's our story to say material, and now when he says it failed, as I can see on the graph, food came because once and want to understand exactly what happened. What was it that they didn't do good for it to fail? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mantash. Is there anyone else coming up? Honourable Nkongi?
Chairperson, when I was asking the first question, I thought we were not yet in a position to engage. So I was just asking that clarity question. But I think Floyd, I'm not going to use other Floyd in the world.
Can I just stop you there? I think we need to perhaps look at that issue because we're not in a committee right now. It's not the colloquium. We're in a workshop, which is more relaxed than a colloquium. Can I put it that way?
Can I take my shoes off?
Well, I don't want to make the wrong remark here, but maybe it was your agreement, members. Normally when we have this training within the committee, we go out to a hotel or somewhere else. We didn't do this now, so it looks as if we're still in Parliament doing things. But with your permission, we can relax the Honourable. Do I have your agreement on that?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we can either use first or second names. All right? Thank you.
Yes, second question, Floyd, provoking. Because that was the matter that I saw is going to be a departure. When I requested that the committee must try to have this workshop, that is where I wanted us to go. Whether are we in a good path in terms of our approach for industrial relations? Because that was the first question that I asked. And then the issue was that is the government policy led in the organization? And I had problems. That why government should only lead policy? And who is going to protect that policy at the end of the day if it's not a state-led industrialization? Well, I give two meanings. That is the difference between a government policy-led industrialization and a government-led industrialization. You know, so I thought that is where we are going to start the debate. Which for me, if a government policy-led industrialization is going to have challenges, because there's going to be resistance, as we can see now in the Republic of South Africa, where there are other firms, in particular industries, that do not implement the industrial policy proposed of South Africa. For example, the value addition issue. It is a challenge. People are still importing material, whether we do have or we can process the material in South Africa. So I think maybe that should be the base. So what Floyd calls it is called it's a philosophical argument. Which philosophy of industrialization that we are leading? You know, yesterday I was reading a Marxism again, and it was explaining the matter of production and the expansion of production, but led by the state, and industrialization was key in Marxism-Leninism. So this is what I want to ask. Which stance are we taking in South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask or have a discussion with Nimrod around his presentation. Specifically, the simplified case study of the steel value chain. If we can just go from iron ore to capital equipment, it creates 150 jobs. But what that presentation or that case study doesn't speak to is the incredible amount of sophistication, assistance, regulation, energy provision, taxation policies, industrial policies, everything that goes in from iron ore to capital equipment. And I don't think that we fundamentally understand the problem that exists in all of those other issues. And I've just skimmed through, and I don't want to have a debate on the report on the colloquium, but it seems to put, we seem to shy away from the what is the state going to do in terms of policy centralization, in terms of energy provision, administrative prices, all those sorts of things like that. And so for me that is a very, very simplified case study, and I don't think I think that if we could get to the capital equipment, I'd be one of the happiest people in the world, but I don't know that
we as a committee fundamentally understand where it takes to go from that point to that point. In terms of the case study on Ethiopia, particularly they had a look at the textile industry, and I think that one of and I just want to ask you quickly, when you got lessons learned, lessons constrained to be addressed, are you talking about what Ethiopia saw or what we need to see in terms of that? Because if it is us to have a look at, then in that particular industry, you know, textile production or weaving of textiles in this country is, you know, frankly pathetic. And I can say this because I come from that industry. About 3 or 4 years ago, there was a proposal put to the KwaZulu-Natal government to partner with private companies in actually growing cotton in South Africa, in KZN. And that price, and at that time, cotton was $1 a kilo. 12 months from that, it tripled to $3 or $3.50 a kilo. And the KZN government said, it can never work, we're not interested in opportunity much. But I think that we have to continue to look at basic input into production and invest in those areas. And not just think that we can go from the iron ore to the manufactured goods overnight, and if we have that resource, if we have that ability, people will just come and factories will just end up. So I'd like to have your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Yes, now, Ms. McKesson was the last one there. I think let's get a response, and this is like really engaging now. We're not trying to prove points or whatever.
No.
So just take it all on board then, and then Nimrod.
Thank you. I think the purpose of this presentation really was to, you know, to try and, first of all, give an alternative perspective, I think, what Honourable Shabamu has spoken of as a, you know, what's sometimes called the heterodox perspective, on how countries have grown and the role of manufacturing and the role of the state in that process in a pretty pragmatic kind of way. And I think also really to provoke thinking, reflection, and further discussions amongst the members of the committee.
Sure.
One of the reasons why, one of the other reasons why I think Ethiopia is an interesting case study is because it allows us to step back a little bit from, you know, perhaps some of our, you know, more or less entrenched positions, given whatever, you know, political parties, you know, members might represent, and just step back and be able to think of it more broadly about the issue. So, and I think the what's interesting for me about the story about, in some ways, the leather and the hide and skin is a more interesting story than what is, you know, pretty obviously a big success story in the cattle aisle. And it's interesting because it's kind of a mixed story. It's not an absolute success, certainly not in terms of the targets that the Ethiopians originally set themselves, but nor is it a complete failure. And I think that there's some lessons in there. But, not obviously knowing and understanding every, you know, minute detail of the Ethiopian, leather sector development, I think that there are a couple of things. So I think one of the reasons why you had exports, or the possibly later reason why you had the exports of raw hides and skins kind of moving sideways and then declining initially, I imagine would be the export tax, which was an objective of the policy. You know, it was, you know, impose an export tax, make it less profitable to export unbeneficiated raw hides and skins, so that the more competitive input of raw hides and skin into the leather sector. So the, you know, the way that I see this is that obviously the Ethiopians would want their leather and footwear sector to take off much more rapidly than, you know, that has. So it's been from exporting $1 million in 2005 to about $9 million in 2011. It didn't hit that. Clearly it didn't perform as they would hope or as they expected. But I think what's also important is that they seem to have then gone back and reflected and said, okay, well, you know, what's worked, what hasn't worked, what more do we need to do? And they've identified these areas that these weaknesses that they need to work on, which is the in particular, I mean, from what I've had access to, the logistics. So there's a big issue with logistics. The fabric bank, although this relates more to the textiles and clothing story, and the quality of the leather. Whether or not, and I don't know the answer to this, I don't know whether have they gone back and said, okay, you know, let's revisit the export tax. I honestly don't know. What's useful and interesting is that they've tried something. It's worked up to a point, you know, in a less limited way than they hoped. Then they said, okay, what do we do? You know, what do we need to learn from this? How do we take this forward? So this kind of adaptation, you know, this learning and adaptation function. I think that's what comes out to me quite strongly on the leather and the hide and skin story.
Because for me, this is one of the strategies, this is a good idea.
Just to point out comments.
That is information that
I'm not running a committee now, so that's why we allowed the interjection. I don't want this to be seen as a precedent for the committee.
No, thank you for that is the crux of the matter that I want us to discuss. Maybe in future you can come with that information, or individually we can do that research. The correlation between the leather, the process, leather in a country and the polymer that they put, but they never succeeded. But what succeeded, the one that they wanted it, that happened. But happened. For example, we talk about the question of processing of our commodities here in South Africa, and then we put tax. But we're not succeeding. What made us? And we're looking at that is obvious. And learn that it is not teaching us something on the political strength that we have in South Africa. So I like that interview, and I want us to follow it.
All right, now let's try not interrupt at the moment, because time is now running against us.
On your question, again, I mean, I don't know the absolute granular detail of this, but my understanding is that the couple of farms are, they're within the proximity of Addis.
So I'm
open to correction, but my understanding is probably that they all go through the Addis Airport. You know, whether I'm not aware that they've expanded the beyond the fairly close proximity to Addis, but it's something one could check. Then I think the question is my understanding of the question is, isn't a government-led policy or a party-led policy, or both? And I think the answer is clearly it's both.
Mm.
So this really, I think, started under the previous Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, who was the head of the Tigrayan People Front. This program has, in my understanding, it's become fundamental to, you know, the political program of the Tigrayan People Front. And their kind of, you know, credibility as a political party, and then it's also been rolled out with, you know, within government. I think another dimension is that they have been, I think, tremendously pragmatic in the way that they've kind of rolled it out in a number of respects. So I think that they haven't, they haven't kind of said, okay, well, only going to be states. You know, state investments,
it's kind of, you know, very pragmatic. We'll use, you know, we'll use the airlines in a particular way. You know, that obviously is a state-owned company. You know, the state might invest in some areas through joint ventures in textiles. Other areas it will be, you know, it will be private investment, some of it. And the other issue is, you know, it's also, you know, should it be national, should it be foreign? You know, they've been very pragmatic in that mix. I think politically, more broadly, in the kind of international political arena, they've been very pragmatic because, for instance, say, in relationships with the United States. So typically, you know, the United States has been quite strongly, certainly not supportive of active state intervention to build an economy. But there's some geopolitical issues that the Ethiopians have played quite well. So for instance, you know, the kind of war on terror in the region, you know, the Ethiopians cooperate with the U.S. And I think they leverage that to violent policy space to do these kinds of programs without too much pushback or interference. So in a variety of ways, I think there's been a tremendous pragmatism. And then the comments from Honourable Shivamu, I think, you know, many of them, I think, are comments. I think some of them I tried to touch on earlier, but perhaps not as, you know, explicitly as he's raised. Chair, I think to a large degree, I mean, unless members, I think I've tried to cover most of the questions except for the Honourable McPherson about the steel value chain. And the, I guess, this is a simplified representation of, you know, of a chain of activity. I don't think it in any way was meant to suggest that, you know, that there's a kind of natural or easy progression from iron ore to, you know, sophisticated capital equipment. It was intended to show the kind of, you know, almost exponential power of value addition that is possible in the manufacturing sector through the transformation of physical, you know, quite basic physical input and the application of knowledge within a manufacturing within the manufacturing process to generate very high level, you know, exponentially greater levels of value addition relative to the underlying raw material. And yes, there are many, many issues that need to be addressed along the way to get from iron ore to you know, to capital equipment. And it's part, you know, this is part of the story of structural transformation, that there's nothing automatic in going from being a miner of iron ore to being a producer of capital equipment. That, you know, that these things require very direct support, conditional support and intervention. In order to develop these kinds of more sophisticated sectors. But I think part of the relevance, of course, and I think it enters the realm of the debate around beneficiation, is that you do get a range of either resource rents or monopoly rents captured at these two stages of the production chain, and this limits the production of first of all, you know, particularly the medium technology or more basic fabrication, and where you can create, that might not be the highest value added product, but you can create a lot of jobs and you can create a lot of value addition in this space if you can, if you aren't getting monopolistic pricing on the raw material. Once you move into this space, the proportion of the raw material price as a
percentage of the selling price gets much, much lower. So both of these are important. And you have activities in this space which affect the competitiveness. You have activities in a more, you know, less sophisticated space, things like the foundry sector. So to do a casting or a forging, it might have value addition similar to that of structural steel, but it's a very important competitive input into, you know, let's say things like engine blocks in the automotive sector. So it affects the, the kind of, if you don't have that, let's call it your basic or intermediate manufacturing capability, it affects, it can affect the competitiveness of your more advanced sector.
Yeah. Members, I just want to remind you, we are continuing this after tea. You see, unless we can thresh this up, the major mandate, two mandates, that is industrialization and trade, with the glue in between the squam and the regulatory framework, etc. So we've got to get a clear understanding. And I thought, you know, some of us are talking very openly about terms such as heterodox and all of this. That's fine. For those who may say that, like a lot, you know, two or three of us in the room, but not more. But not everyone is entirely familiar with this. And I think Nimrod is maybe pertinent just at this point. If someone uses a label like that, there's nothing wrong. There's something wrong if not everyone is on board. And there are some folks way ahead on this issue and others way ahead on another issue, you know, as it were. And even when it comes to heterodox, I mean, there are different views on this kind of definition. What are you talking about? Is it sort of socialism, Marxism, what post-Keynesian, new Keynesian, or is it another way of classifying them and so on? I mean, you know, even as we talk, they are debating these differences, you see. But at least let's get the committee, as it were, on board with some shared understanding of it. Because no matter what we say, it's political. So without getting party political, and I think that's the issue, we need to avoid the parochialism which may be linked to political parties and rather to rise above that. And I think the thing was that was raised by someone, you know, the market economy, is it going to be intervention by the state or not? And there was a series on TV last year, I think it was, or maybe early this year, telling us all about the American economy and how it was built. And if anything was interventionist, that was interventionist, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah. So what we'll do is, I have seen your hand for the next round, Jordan, and so what we'll do is when we're back from tea.
Is the tea there?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It's just tea now. We're not getting all the food, just tea. Or coffee, and then come back about 7 or 10 minutes. Thanks. Now, members, I'm a little bit concerned. I gave everyone off Tuesday because it was Heritage Day Wednesday on the understanding that we would have 2 full days, Thursday and Friday, for training. This is not a new decision. It's an old decision. Now, I am not going to cut the training. That's what I will not do. But what we can do is we do try to work with people. We really do. But we can't have people always jumping in and wanting to leave early. I too would like to sleep in my own bed and go and work in the political constituency. But we all have challenges. So we're going to try, and as soon as I can get the program for tomorrow and to see what's on, I'm going to try and bring some of the programs in today. And we'll see what we can do. But the rest assured I'll do my best. can we leave it like that? I'm going to try to reduce tomorrow to 1 o'clock, if possible. So let's move, but we're not cutting things. We'll extend today. Right now, there were other questions for the industrial development, and then I'll get someone to take over. Margaret, will you please call the committee back? Honourable,
yes, Mr. Hill-Lewis. Thanks, Chair. Thank you very much. Sorry, Mr. Zog, that I missed your presentation, but I've read through the slides now. I was called out to another brief meeting downstairs. Let me say, I really like that slide that's on the screen right now, because I think it gives graphical attention to the fact that industrial policy does not only belong in the Department of Trade and Industry. It's a what's called a transversal. I always find that word quite confusing, but it cuts right across government in many departments, and it has lots of different priorities. And many of them are just as important as the other parts. Many of the parts are just as important as the other parts. So infrastructure is critical, absolutely critical. And I like how it's graphically shown there that all of those things are just as important as each other. So that was just a comment. Then I wanted to move on to your presentation. Firstly, we still seem to be spending a lot of time talking about why industrial policy is necessary. I hope you don't feel like you need to convince us, because I take industrial policy for granted. Every country in the world has an industrial policy. Well, every serious country in the world today has an industrial policy.
Sorry, Mr. Louis.
Hello, ma'am.
You are up from it, because we are supposed to get this particular presentation.
I got it, yeah.
No, this one. It was not presented to the committee.
No,
it's here. It's there, but it was not finished.
Oh, I see.
Can we allow Mr. Mimbo then to finish off?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we went up to it, it would be a case study.
Thank you, Chair. The purpose of this next section, I think, is in particular to introduce members who haven't previously served on this portfolio committee to the way in which a range of policy issues tie together. And also, I think, to iterate out and identify some issues which are extremely important for the success of industrial policy, but as the Honourable Hill-Lewis pointed out, are not within the direct control of the Department of Trade and Industry. And these are largely represented by these circles on the right-hand side with the white text. And then more specifically a range of areas where the DTI has more direct control over a number of policy instruments. To emphasize how these need to work together as a kind of integrated whole. So I think let me start off with some of the areas outside of the direct control of the department, but try and touch on their relevance for industrial policy. So macroeconomic policy is obviously has a very powerful bearing on the manufacturing sector on efforts to promote industrial policy, and this includes through instruments like the interest rate and the exchange rate. It's impacted by the structure of the financial sector, and in particular the way in which the sector does or does not pull together savings within the economy and allocate those savings to productive investment opportunities within the economy. So I think some of the relevant issues around finance include whether the financial system, broadly speaking,
is focusing on the extension of short versus long-term finance. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence that there's been a significant shift towards shorter sources, shorter term types of finance being extended in the economy, particularly for consumption-related activities, relative to longer-term finance for investment-related activities. This extension of finance for shorter-term consumption activities has obviously impacted on the economy in terms of things like the rising household debt level, which I spoke to a little bit earlier, issues like the extension of unsecured credit and the impact that has on communities and, I suppose, more recently, you know, on the financial system itself, as well as the type of financing instruments that are extended by various players in the financial sector, the extent to which there is the development of a range of financial instruments for trading purposes as distinct from financial instruments which are for brick and mortar investment. And these issues are not unique to South Africa, and I've got being, you know, debated in many countries in the world. The nature of infrastructure provision is extremely important. I think we are all very aware that of the impact of the electricity sector on other sectors of the economy, such as the manufacturing sector. So the pricing, the reliability of that infrastructure and the distribution system is extremely important. And the rail and port system. And I think a broad, let's say, stellar fact that perhaps we can draw out from the nature of infrastructure provision in South Africa is that there continues to be a strong bias in our infrastructure provision towards the production and export of raw commodities. So one sees that in, for instance, the direct provision of electricity and more favourable pricing to large electricity-intensive users, but also in terms of a configuration of our rail and port system, where a lot of that system of rails and ports is really dedicated infrastructure for the export of unbeneficiated commodities. And I don't think anybody would suggest, you know, that one should not, you know, dismantle that system, not have mineral exports and so forth. But it's a question of, you know, appropriate balance and a question of whether the infrastructure provision is lagging or leading the demands of industrial development. A couple of examples of this, how it's practically affecting the manufacturing sector. One is that value-added exporters pay additional fees called cargo dues for the when they use the port system as a way of contributing to the expansion of ports infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Another relevant factor is that there are a number of opportunities that are possible if we can place the right infrastructure for it. So, for instance, the exploration of oil and gas along the east and west coasts of the continent creates a very significant opportunity for South Africa to service oil and gas activities and do a lot of manufacturing related to the servicing of these rigs, but it requires dedicated infrastructure at the ports. So ports
can be ports and other forms of infrastructure are extremely important enablers of entirely new economic activity and new subsectors. Competition policy has a very important role to play in the economy, and in particular in South Africa, firstly in relation to intermediate inputs into downstream manufacturing activities, where we are aware of a generalized monopoly provision problem in relation to a range of intermediate inputs into manufacturing, particularly in the in relation to intermediate metals and plastics products. And competition policy also has an important role to play in ensuring in social protection of poor and working class households, and a focus on ensuring that there isn't excessive pricing in relation to the goods and services that these households consume. Education and skills is also very important for industrial development, including, or in particular, the efficient provision of vocational training, taking one step back into the educational system itself, the provision of so-called SET skills, science, engineering and technology skills. The innovation and technology support functions provided by departments like science and in particular science and technology, are important in providing support for primary and industrial research. This kind of innovation support goes beyond this type of research to also provide, needs to provide support for commercialization of innovations that are developed within the country, and those include things like process and product improvements, which are often the source of very significant increases in industrial capabilities, notwithstanding that they may not, you know, they may not represent large scientific breakthroughs. But for kind of middle income countries like South Africa, these process, supporting process and product improvements and commercialization of technology is tremendously important. So let me then turn to moving from the broader kind of policy terrain to, I think, some more instruments that are, if not directly within the ETI's control, but certainly more strongly connected to the ETI's influence, sphere of influence. And that includes industrial financing. And so some of the industrial financing mechanisms that exist and are provided are what we call so-called on-budget incentives, and these are administered and disbursed directly from within a division of the Department of Trade and Industry called the Industrial Development Administration Division. The development finance institutions, the development banks, are another extremely important source of industrial finance, and the most obvious institution as far as this is concerned is the Industrial Development Corporation. Another important function and institution is the creation of export credit and insurance. So exporters require a particular type of finance to get into export markets, particularly if they are providing inputs into big capital projects. And so the export credit insurance plays a very important role and is served predominantly by an entity which reports into the DTI called the Export Credit Insurance Corporation. Procurement and public procurement has recently become a much more important and direct instrument of industrial policy through changes to the preferential procurement regulation. And these in turn allow the Department of Trade and Industry, after a thorough kind of research process,
to designate certain sectors and products that are procured by public entities be procured with from local suppliers with minimum levels of local content. So this is obviously the kinds of things that are procured by state-owned enterprises and government itself. And some of the sectors that have been designated fairly recently include things like rail, rolling stock, so the locomotives and carriages and wagons for the rail program, clothing and textile products that are procured by the state, certain types of pharmaceuticals, and a range of other products. Trade policy, which my two colleagues, Basil and Kelly, will obviously speak to in much greater detail, has a whole range of dimensions to it. In the first instance, it is influenced by our trade negotiations that we undertake at the multilateral level through the World Trade Organization. So this is our commitment broadly to other trading partners who are members of the World Trade Organization. We also have regional trade deals or trade agreements with regions like the European Union and SADC, the Southern African Development Community. And then, of course, there are also some bilateral trade relations and trade arrangements. Those agreements, those trade agreements, set up a lot of the kind of rules of the game and the space in which some of these policy instruments can be implemented. And in particular, the policy instruments include things like tariffs, import tariffs. These are the taxes, essentially, that are levied on particular kinds of imports in line with our industrial development strategy for particular sectors and some other considerations. And this tariff system is administered by a body called ITAC, which is the International Trade Administration Commission. They also administer some other instruments, which are, let's call it, somewhat more extraordinary trade instruments, like anti-dumping and countervailing duties. These are instruments where, let's say, for instance, another country is selling products into the South African market that are below the cost at which those products are sold in their own market of origin. This is considered potentially an unfair trade practice, or products that are subsidized in another market can also be subject to countervailing duties, and this is also a function of ITAC to administer and consider applications for these duties. Another very important area which I've kind of placed within the trade policy realm, but I think it actually goes beyond the trade policy realm, is the work related to technical infrastructure and standards. So these are bodies like the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, which establishes the kind of compulsory standards that particular types of products need to comply with, the South African Bureau of Standards, which administers a system of voluntary standards, I forget for the moment the name of the institution, but there's a lot of work around establishing the underlying basis of these standards. So the National Metrology Institute of South Africa also fall within this system of standards or technical infrastructure. And this is tremendously important, though it's not very it's tremendously important work, although it's kind of, let's say, with all kind of due respect to Chenge, it's not necessarily considered the sexiest kind of area of work, but one of the functions that the technical infrastructure institutions play is to establish standards for new industries to get off the ground. So, for instance, we want to establish a biofuels industry in South Africa. The biofuels need to meet certain product specifications so that people can know whether or not, you know, the biofuels that they purchase has a particular octane level and a range of other characteristics of the place, etc. So you need this technical infrastructure system to be able to establish those standards for a number of industries actually to function. It also plays an important role in helping us distinguish between very low quality imports, which may have characteristics which consumers can't detect, like is a particular product safe? You know, you can't visually detect that it is made out of let's say possum pan. There's a claim that it's made out of stainless steel, but no consumer would know up front is this thing going to rust in 2 months' time. So it has a very important role to play in that space, and also in getting into export markets where the ability to get into a range of export markets requires the meeting of quite sophisticated standards, particularly let's say in markets like the EU and the US. Strongly linked to the trade policy agenda is the regional integration agenda. So one aspect of that are the various regional trade agreements that we have, for instance with the EU and SADC. But there's a very strong recognition that that in order for South Africa to grow and prosper and industrialize, the regions need to industrialize and grow and prosper. And that requires that, in addition, that our regional integration agenda is not limited or should not be limited to these trade agreements, but also has to support things like the installation of physical infrastructure within the region, as well as the development of value chains within the region and productive capacity within the region. Again, linked to trade, the investment and export promotion work that is undertaken largely through a division of the DTI called TISA, the Trade and Investment South Africa, and they promote foreign direct investment into South Africa, but they also promote exports of South African products in a whole range of markets around the world. Black economic empowerment in general, and the development of black industrialists in particular, is also a very important element of industrial policy, and it's an area which really aims to move black industrialists into the manufacturing sector in a long-term and committed way. So to move, let's say, beyond kind of short-term participation in sectors through participation one-off kind of participation in a particular project to what we would call deep entrepreneurship within the manufacturing sector, where you have long-term industrialists who are heavily invested in the manufacturing sector and actively manage those investments in the manufacturing sector. And part of the support necessary in that area is partly to the finance, but also skills development in that space. Intellectual property is also a matter which touches on industrial policy, and I think that the committee has considered a number of issues in the space. And of course, there are many, many issues related to intellectual property. From an industrial policy perspective, there are probably a couple that we can highlight that link intellectual property to industrial property. And that is, the general emphasis, I think, of the intellectual property system in South Africa you know, should the role of the intellectual property system be predominantly aimed at trying to serving the role of protecting the intellectual property of external importers into the South African market and protecting their intellectual property. And of course, we have commitments in this regard, and that's an important function of the intellectual property system. But I think the deeper question is around how we leverage intellectual property for things like the commercialization of intellectual property that's been developed in South Africa, and also look at how it can open up certain production opportunities. So for instance, depending on what stance a country takes in relation to intellectual property with respect to pharmaceuticals, one can, for instance, open up opportunities to produce certain types of pharmaceuticals in a country like South Africa that, say, other intellectual property regimes might have foreclosed on in other countries. The chair, that really, I think, is an overview of the range of policy areas that touch on the work of DEI externally, and also I think the range of policy areas that the committee can expect to engage with in relation to its work on industrial policy and its oversight of the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nimbert. I'm now open for questions and clarities and discussion. And I'll start with the Honorable Hill Lewis, because he was already on the platform.
Thank you.
Honorable Mkwengi.
Thank you very much. Just to go back to my comments, Mr. Zalt, I've just spent nearly a month in the US looking at state level trade and investment policy in America, and the industrial policy at the state level is ubiquitous, even if it's not at the federal level. And we know from the very excellent readings that you gave us and other readings that you know, in Southeast Asia and Brazil, Argentina, Chile, industrial policy really is ubiquitous. So that is almost beyond debate. The debate then becomes, what does industrial policy look like? And that's really the critical debate. I want to say a couple of things about, you know, I think all of us, firstly, I don't think it's healthy to have any entrenched position when it comes to economics and development policy. I think part of the problem with economics is that there's far too much political philosophy inserted into what is a science. There's more than enough evidence. It's not an exact science, to be sure, but it is a science. And so there's no entrenched position. Presented with the evidence, every person should be willing to change their position or at least reconsider their position, presented with sufficiently strong evidence. That said, when I lay awake at night dreaming about the future of South Africa, I'm afraid I don't dream about Ethiopia. I dream about Australia, maybe. I dream about Japan or South Korea or Taiwan or, you know, one of the other formerly middle-income countries that have successfully developed. But I don't dream about those countries who are right near the bottom of the United Nations Human Development Index. So I'm not sure that is the most particularly useful example to come up, but I also know a little bit about the Ethiopian economy. I've read a little bit about it. I mean, number one, it can't really be described as a democracy. It's an authoritarian government, effectively one-party state. There's none of the union organizing rights that we have here, none of the or limited minimum wage and related protections that we have here. There's no free speech for the media. They have a controlled inflation rate. Exchange rates. They don't have free floating currency. And for the past few years at least, they've had more than 60% inflation. I think it's just recently gone down to now about 25%, the inflation rate. But you can imagine what that does to the lives of poor people in a developing country. Inflation is the worst enemy of the poor. So I'm not sure that that's useful. Also, just in comparative terms, we are infinitely more developed already and industrialized than Ethiopia. So I think in the readings that he gave us, and I really want to thank you for the readings, there's some much better examples from Southeast Asia of countries at similar points in their development trajectory to us, who have successfully made use of industrial policy and have developed and have become wealthy, developed countries. I wanted to refer specifically to a reading by Hajun Chang, which I really enjoyed. And this is where I really want to ask some questions, because Chang, on page 7, he makes this critical point about what countries do with their traditional industries. And he made the point, and I strongly agree with him, that you cannot sacrifice your traditional industries for the promise of some future industry which you don't yet have. You've got to use your traditional industries as a platform from which to build. And he makes the cogent economic point that traditional industries have to supply jobs and the technology and, importantly, the foreign exchange necessary in the short term with which you can build new technology and new industry in the long term. And this is where I get really concerned about talk of export taxes and price controls and all the things which really undermine investment in those industries in which South Africa already is a world leader. And of course, we want to see our economy diversifying. That goes without saying. But we want to see that on top of what we already have, not at the expense of what we already have. And so one of the other points that Jane makes in the reading, I'll also just stop at that point, Chair, and say that I got hold of a book by Chang last week called Kicking Away the Ladder, in which he makes several of these same points, and I recommend it to members. I'm busy working through it right now, and it's extremely well put together. He makes the point that at the beginning stage of industrialization, those traditional industries are critical for providing foreign exchange, because foreign exchange funds the trade deficit. And foreign exchange funds the import of existing technologies from developed countries which we can use to spread technology and manufacture using those technologies now in the short term, the short to medium term. So in that context, these are some of the questions and issues that I'm working through in my own mind, but in that context it's the discussion of export taxes, where we have 6.5% trade deficit in South Africa, and we rely on basically mining exports to fund that deficit with US dollars, and discussion of price controls, where it really worries me. I'm not sure that is the best example of industrial policy to follow, because as Chang warns, this is jeopardizing our traditional industries. I think it's actually useful just to read this paragraph, Chair, because it says that, first of all, this is not to say that a country should ignore its traditional industries. First of all, it takes a lot of time to develop new industries. It took 40 years for the Japanese car makers to break into the world market. It took 17 years for Nokia Electronics to make any profit at all. So before the new industries fully develop, the natural resource-based sectors need to provide the output, the jobs, and above all, the export earnings, foreign exchange, that will finance the imports of machinery and technologies for the new industries. The scope of upgrading in natural resource-based industries are not to be underestimated. So that really underscores an important point for me, and I just want to hear your thoughts on that and probably start a discussion around that. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Thank
you very much, Chairperson. I like to welcome this presentation, because this presentation goes back to what we were discussing before on the direction of industrialization in South Africa. And I asked that question deliberately because I want us to answer that question. Well, I'm saying industrialization in South Africa is government-led. I'm talking about government taking strategic sectors of the economy and drive industrialization in those focused sectors. They can choose, there are many countries that have done that thing. Or we are saying that it's a policy led by government. Now, if I'm saying it's a policy led, then the government drafts a policy and mobilize society to accept that policy. But not taking charge of particular industries or sectors of the economy and driving them through an industrial project. This is what I want us to do. And look at what are the technicalities in South Africa that make us not to succeed. That example of Ethiopia, I like it. The relationship between, you said, that graph, I like it, and then I said, you need to really check whether they were not checkered there by people, yes, by people who were against their industrial project. Because in Ethiopia, they took a policy decision, enough leather, articles, and footwear, that they are going to support it. But it never succeeded. The only thing that succeeded is the one that, by law, they say they must reduce. I'm particularly interested in terms of the raw materials in South Africa. Platinum, steel, and so forth. Where was it that we need to push them for value addition and so forth? But we're still struggling. Import, I mean, currency pricing and other related matters, which for me, that example of Ethiopia, it brings life to the debate.
So I
want us to discuss. Maybe it's going to be future discussion. Some of us, these are the issues that we can put them in our own political studies, in terms of the policy positions that we take at this moment, whether it is the right policy direction. But I agree that economics is a science, I agree. But it's a social science. And that is why it takes care of the social relations in a particular society. And that is why the question of dependence theories are becoming a problem. You know, where would like everything that is applied in South Africa to be always foreign, and not having our own design and direction. You know, because the question of the kicking of the ladder is opening up our eyes on the matter of the dependency theory. Because it's telling us that industrialization is an old age issue, and it cannot succeed in the 21st century. And therefore the countries are not encouraged to implement it. So we depend on that particular theory of people who have implemented it, but they are taking it. So it's very important for us to look at our social relations in South Africa and what industrialization can assist us to develop our economy and create more jobs. I'm particularly interested because, you know, my worry is that are we talking about a political will of elected representatives or we're talking about a national will? Because here we're looking at our national interest as a country. Now, in order industrialization to succeed in the Republic of South Africa, in our own view, we must have a national support. Because if this program, you talk about value addition, beneficiation, is going to be attacked by our own media, it's going to be attacked by people who do not want South Africa to succeed, it's not going to succeed. That is why when we talk about the political will, for me, it's not about the question of whether Mandela wants it because of he's the president of the Republic of South Africa or the nation wants it. So the national interest is very important. And I'm not raising this because of I'm a nationalist, perhaps I'm not a nationalist. I'm not a socialist, but the matter of the national interest becomes very important. The last matter that I want I want the debate to go is maybe I thought I didn't know that Floyd is raising it, saying that it is a heterodox perspective. do we really want to encourage in South Africa that our mineral resources must continue to go to other foreign countries without benefiting our own country? I'm going to benefit. Is that what we want to be the future of South Africa? If you look at the classical colonialism, where our raw material processed in a foreign country and be sold in South Africa, do we want to still follow that? And is that a better option in the 21st century? So this becomes to be in the heart of the debate, you know, of the national question in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Accept.
Thank you, Chair. You know, the thing about industrialization is that you only get one opportunity probably in a generation to do it. If you do it wrong, that opportunity doesn't come back again. And so when you embark on industrialization, you have to be damn sure that all your ducks are in a row. And so there is nothing wrong with looking at world best practice. There is nothing wrong with saying what is the best path to choose. Well, there is nothing wrong with looking at outside countries like Japan or Germany or whatever and saying they got it right. There was a reason why they got it right, and maybe we should follow suit. And the problem that we have is that, you know, we look for shadows where none exist. We think there's, you know, a boogeyman hiding around the corner who's going to come and take everything away from us and leave us with nothing. And that doesn't help. And in fact, it slows down and it ensures that we miss that opportunity in a generation. And I think that what my colleague Jordan has put on the table today is certainly sobering. And if it doesn't give you something to think about, then I question your commitment to industrializing countries. And rather using industrialization as a political football to score points, instead of actually saying, how do we use industrialization to uplift the economy of this country and create millions of jobs, the 11 million jobs that are required through the NDP by 2030. And I think that really has to be the point of departure. Instead of looking at one another across the table saying, you know, how can I, you know, kick one over you, and, you know, we must use this example because those people might have tendencies of colonialists or whatever bizarre things we think about when we go to sleep. We actually need to look at who's done it best, what were the common threads, and how do you pick those up and ensure that we can use that to our advantage? Because if we miss it, it's not going to come back and we will be relegated to the second-rate team while the rest of Africa and the rest of our peers, the rest of our neighbors continue to soar at 7-8% growth, and we are, you know, hoping at best that we can just make it past 1.5.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Shrum.
Thanks. My understanding, Louis, of export taxes is mainly on primary commodities, so that those who are producing the primary commodities are forced to locally benefit in industrialist. It must be difficult to take primary commodities like basic minerals out of the country. It must not be a product border out of the country, like taking all the basic resources. The whole question of export taxes comes in that context. So obviously, in the immediate, it will affect the dollar of Kenya, but in the long run, it's going to contribute significantly to any foreign currency, because, as was elaborated earlier, with steel, if you export primary commodity, raw as it is, it's going to be cheaper. You're going to earn lesser foreign currency than if you process it and industrialize it. And that is the logic behind the position of export taxes. on tomorrow commodities. So it's a long-term project. That is what industrial policy is all about. And I think the most important thing which the what implementers of industrial policy need to look into is the order of the trade policy. I think the approach that's why I've been lacklustre in the sense that there is no identification of goods and services which we can locally produce. We need to look into what constitutes our import basket, what are the goods and services that we are importing, and which of those can we locally produce. And then we then have a double-pronged intervention on the ones that we locally produce, build capacity to locally produce those goods and services, give them subsidies of whatever form, and then put tariffs on the importation of those goods and services that we can locally produce so that we protect our industries in a different form. There are lots of unnecessary imports into South Africa. In the case of plastic, for instance, we produce the raw material that produces plastic in Sasol. We take it to China and then it comes back as a finished goods and services and products. And those are some of the areas which we can say that of all, particularly the consumables and services, the things that we use on a daily basis, we can identify that these are the areas where we need to make concrete interventions on, and then support those industries. You know, unfortunately, I think the lessons we can only learn from the late industrialism. I think that can be, if we want to give comparisons, I don't know how well we can learn from the U.S. industrialization path, but I think the path which was taken by the late industrializers, the ones that industrialized post World War II, is better lessons that we can learn from, because one, they were catching up industrializing countries. They were industrializing in a context of already the natural supremacy of the Western world of Europe and the U.S. They were catching up. Even the industrial program and development in South Africa must pursue. It's a catch-up industrial expansion program where you've got countries which have got superior industries and you must compete with them. And there are different things that you must be done differently. I think we can get lots of lessons from the East Asian countries. And one of those lessons is to have a very strong development finance institutions, like industrial development finance institutions. South Korea was the Industrial Bank of Korea. In Singapore, it was the Central Provident Fund, which financed almost all the catch-up industries. Yes, of course, with a lot of risks involved, but that is what it takes to catch up on industrialization. You need to take the risks in finance industries, some of which will not make returns in terms of within a political, they won't make returns in a political term. It will take you 10 years and, or even 15 years to gain returns on some of the areas. But now, I don't think we currently have mobile BFIs which can finance a vigorous industrial expansion project. I don't have much faith in the IDC. And also, doesn't look like within the industrial policy action plan, the government has got much faith in IDC. Well, I don't know whether there's a relegation to give to economic development then, when IPEP is supposed to be overseen from a trade in the industry. I'm so pleased when I say this is what you must do and everything. There won't always be coincidences of what DTI wants IDC to do and what economic development was IDC to do. Those are some of the mechanical things that must be looked into in dealing with those issues. But also in the long run, there should be a global consideration and a natural bank of South Africa with relative autonomy to finance what could be successful industries. And I think that is how we can pursue a much more cogent industrial expansion program. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. The last speaker will be Honourable Link.
Thank you. Thank you.
Not another side.
Thank you, Chairman. Briefly, Chair, mine would be to say we must not behave as if when we're talking to this industrialization, it's like we are talking of a very new concept. In this country, even today as we are sitting here, industries are doing well, but the poor does not benefit. Before 1994, this country was highly industrialized. Even the rural areas like your Eastern Cape, Butterworth, Mtata, Timbaza, there were huge industries there. And those industries were either assisted financially by those bankers, Tanzania and sister government were funding those industries, and people were working. Then immediately after 1994, they were closed down. Not closed down by government, by the drivers and owners of such industries, in order that people would see a difference between pre and post 1994 government. Now when government is actually going back and say, let us revive, let us re-establish those industries, then there is a lot of English that is being used. There is a lot of feasibility studies that are needed. What is the feasibility study for when we know that those industries going to Zimbabwe, they are always there, you can go to Butterworth, they are that side there, and people are not working. We used to sell in those factories sheepskins and cattle. When you slaughter a cow, the owner of the cow knows that I will get money out of this even if I was doing something else. Everything that they did, because that was industrialization at that particular level. But now, I'm failing to understand the reason why would we think this IDC. No, this IDC. The IDC is not beneficial to the poor. You'll find doctors, the conglomerate of doctors, saying we want our own hospitals, the private hospitals. They've got their private practices, and then they are the group, as a group, they own that, and it is fully funded by the state. And we are also trying out here to say, let us emphasize more the importance of the state involvement. The involvement of the state is there, but it is misdirected. It benefits those who are privileged already by now. There are new hospitals in Dada, Bombe Mandase. And when you ask, well, who are the owners of this hospital, new on the N2, towards Madiba's place, a huge hospital, private hospital, owned by these young doctors that are there, and they are well connected even to IDC of officials. And we need to go out and see as to who the beneficiaries
connect to who?
Connected to officials in the department.
Oh.
Yeah. It becomes very easy for them to get funding. They are sitting in their surgery, but they are owners of that. At the end of the day, they are the ones who are saying, you know, this government is not assisting us. When they assist themselves.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Mr. Nimrod, to have it.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think there are many issues raised, and I don't think the intention of the presentation was to try and set out a kind of definitive definition of industrial policy, and how it should be conducted in South Africa, but rather to set out a context with some principles and a couple of case studies that inform thinking and debate about industrial policy. And I think it's safe to say that it certainly has in the discussion around the panel. I do, however, believe that it was valuable to provide the case study of Ethiopia for a variety of reasons, some of which I indicated earlier. One is that there's widespread One of the widespread views, I think it's heard in South Africa as well, is, look, yes, perhaps in theory industrial policy can work, but, you know, it will never, can't work, you don't have a capable state, and essentially no African country is possible of mounting, developing a state sufficiently capable of mounting a serious industrial policy. So you've got this example of one of the poorest countries in the world, which has mounted, an industrial policy which has significantly more success than failure, which has allowed it to grow over a decade by over 10% per annum, admittedly off a low base. I mean, one way to think about this issue of role models and appropriateness of role models is to kind of go back in time a little bit and, you know, to the 1960s, where Ghana actually had a higher GDP per capita than South Korea. And I suspect that, one certainly could have said at that time, you know, South Korea is no role model for South Africa. But the South Koreans did some things that made, you know, which at the time when they were much lower level development than South Africa. Who knows what the Ethiopian energy? We don't know. We can't predict. But I think I also think there are no wholesale lessons from one country to another country. You know, certainly Ethiopia does not have the democratic systems that South Africa has. I don't think anybody around the table would suggest that we want to, you know, adopt their political system, even if that were, you know, viable, which it's not. But I think the issue about case studies and role models is to say, you know, are there some more general principles that can be drawn out? And I think that for me there are a couple from Ethiopia. In addition to the fact that it's achieved what it has from a very, you know, underdeveloped base and a position where many would not have predicted that would be possible. But other things I think that stand out from the Ethiopian case story, the levels of coordination to make these programs happen is one. I think levels of ambition and learning by doing. I think that the leather case study is interesting for us precisely because it's ambiguous. It's not an outright success, nor is it an outright failure. I think what will be really interesting and useful to watch is to say how will the Ethiopians adapt to this program? How will they adapt their program? It wasn't a plug for export taxes in a vacuum, you know, or it wasn't a plug for export taxes per se. I think the broader issue is that instruments should follow strategies. So is an export tax a legitimate instrument? Yes, under the right circumstances with the right strategy. Under other circumstances, maybe not. I don't even know, quite frankly, whether, you know, what the Ethiopians have done over recent years with the export tax. Have they abandoned it? Have they continued? I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, it would be useful to find out. Then I think, perhaps the committee might want to invite Professor Hajin Chang, because I'm not sure he would necessarily agree with the interpretation conveyed of his work. But I think the broad point is correct. The intention is not, you know, I don't think any sensible person wants to say that, you know, that the way to develop a more modern industry is to destroy a traditional industry. I don't think anybody seriously believes that. I think the context in which this has been mostly, this kind of argument has been propounded is
has been in a context of trade liberalisation, where the idea is that, you know, you actually you do large scale liberalisation of certain sectors, and then somehow magically some other sector will spring up and take its place, which is just partly the clothing and textile story in South Africa. So Chair, you know, I think you know, those really are would be my closing remarks on the matters that have been raised. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. We are now moving over to technical infrastructure, and I'll hand over the chairpersonship to Nemantash. Thank you, comrades. I'm feeling more convinced as I still listen to the presentations and the engagement over the last actually that the old order is non-sustainable. And there's no way that we can work against reindustrializing this country. But as I sit here, I'm here to call upon Mr. Chief Imana to make a presentation. Over to you, sir.
Good morning, honorable members. Thank you, Chairperson, for giving me the opportunity to discuss the technical infrastructure. With the background and the context that Nimrod has given, I think I'll just move straight into my presentation. So I won't talk to industrial policy at all. However, maybe it's safe to say that what I'm going to talk about today is something that we all of us know intuitively. It's just a matter of the definition of term that is sometimes confusing. But otherwise, the story is very clear. Okay, so with that, the way I organize the presentation is I follow the information that I was given, that I should start with the definition of what a technical infrastructure is, and then talk to why it is important to the economy. Then I will talk to the mandate of the various organizations that work in this regard. I'll talk a little bit on governance and the linkage to the WTO. It will be very brief because we're going to get a full presentation on WTO later, and the role that the department plays. Okay, so to start with, we know that with globalization, there's a lot of demands are being placed on countries to demonstrate that they have a quality system to guarantee that the products that they sell are safe and are equal for people. We know that consumers worldwide are very demanding of high quality. So quality infrastructure system is that system. Quality infrastructure, technical infrastructure, is a system that allows an economy to test norms and standards and test against the standards to determine whether the products are safe or are fit for their intended purpose. So being fit for what a product is designed for, it's quality. We say something is of quality if it can do what it's supposed to do. In South Africa, we refer to the quality system, therefore, as the technical infrastructure. So it's just the term that we're choosing, that we'll call it the technical infrastructure, because we see it's important as similar to the importance of other infrastructure aspects, such as the road network, the telephone network, the electricity network system. So we see it to be of similar importance as those. We also sometimes refer to it as a SQAM, S-A-Q-A-M, standing for Standard Quality Assurance Accreditation and Metrology. I'm going to define this term later in the slide. The picture's not sure. Yeah.
I think we okay, apparently the picture doesn't show on the screen, but on the slide, I hope everybody has seen the slide. Here on this slide, what I was trying to represent is to show that although we now talk in terms of globalization, even in earlier times, a quality system was always necessary. We see from this picture that a quality system based on measurement was also used in Egypt, where we are showing a picture of a measurement of length, which was called the cubit. It's similar to a ruler. In those times, a decision was nearly taken to say that from today we are going to use this as a measurement. So in this case, it was the length of the arm of the pharaoh that was ruling at the time that was used as the standard for measurement. And using this kind of measurement, the Egyptians were able to develop further. They were able to build very complex systems such as the pyramid. So we see that really the quality infrastructure system is quite important for development in that sense. So moving on to the definitions of terms, I think it's important to define all the terms that we're using so that we are clear. I feel that we intuitively do understand what is required and what is done. It's just that the terms themselves sometimes are confusing. So starting with the standard, in terms of the international system of the ISO, International System Organization, International Standardization Organization, a standard is defined as a document approved by a recognized body that provides for common and accepted use rules, guidelines, or characteristics for product and related processes for production methods. On the slide, I had a small sketch of a document standard from ISO where they have a design standard, the manufacturing standard, and the production and the process standard, but it's not, it didn't show up there. So the work that's done for standards, then it's development of this documented standard. So it's codifying the processes that are used, and these standards can either be voluntarily used by industry and other sectors, or they can be compulsory in the sense that government requires that that standard be met for a product or a process. The next level is that of ensuring that products do meet the standard standards, and that is known as conformity assessment, which is the processes of determining whether a product or service or system meets requirements of a particular standard. And the work that's done there then will be to certify, to inspect, to calibrate, or to test against a given standard. And the results will be reports that say that something do meet the required standard. Then you have accreditation that talks to a formal procedure by which an authoritative body gives recognition that a facility is competent to bear specific tasks. And there what is done is that a person or a facility is audited and to make sure that they actually do comply with the requirements. And again, if you do comply, you'll be given a certificate to that effect. All this is based on a measurement system, which is metrology, which is the science of measurement itself. We see, and again on this slide, I had shown how nowadays metrology, the scientific basis for measurement is actually derived from scientific principles. It's no longer just an arbitrary decision as it was in the past. So in the work in metrology then will be to maintain the standards that you have, to be able to develop those standards from scientific principles, and to be able to do very high order calibration for other users. Uh, this is keeping a slide. My next slide talks to the key elements of the technology system, the framework itself, and again, it's just a repeat of the previous slide where we talked to the fact that we have metrology, we have standards, we have accreditation, and we also have regulations. And regulations are coming from the standards that have been made compulsory by government. Okay, now that we are on the same page in terms of what the signal infrastructure is, we move on to why the signal infrastructure is important in the economy. The work or the activities of the technical infrastructure are instrumental in developing and growing manufacturing capabilities. It was mentioned before by Nimrod that it is critical, supportive to industrial policy. These activities are actually an objective measure of competitiveness of firms. So if we are going to measure the competitiveness of firms based on the product they produce or the work that they do, we will look at the quality of that work, and that quality then is what the technical infrastructure gives you. As mandatory regulation, the technical infrastructure activities provide risk-based requirements for the protection of health, safety, environment and the consumer. So they go beyond just helping the economy and manufacturing, but they also go to the social needs of our communities, in the sense that they protect against unsafe products, and they also protect the consumer when they make transactions. So these activities are actually very vital for a firm, for an economy to participate in a global space. Okay, and moving on to, now just looking at some examples in the trade space, we see that measurements or standards are key to transactions that are taken, that are made in the economy as a whole. Some products are called in terms of mass, so then the scale that does the measurement of course will have to be calibrated and tested correctly. Some products come prepackaged, like the bins that I showed you. So the label will have to tell the truth about how the mass of the content. So if it says 400 grams, then it should be 400 grams. Sorry. Okay, in addition, the quality of a product can also depend on the time it takes to process. And in such cases, then we can talk how often does the bus come to a specific station. And in that case, the standard that will be used will be a management standard. And the ISO 9001 is one such standard from the International Standards Organization, ISO. Okay. Moving on, still on trade, we see that a number of products that are sold are now made from different countries. In this case, we have a car as an example. We know that the components do not necessarily have to come from the same factory or from the same country. So standards allow for interoperability, that is that components that from various areas can be put together and integrated into one product or into one system. So to be able to participate in the value chain, raw material, parts and assembly, one has to meet their requirements, and these requirements will be translated to the seller as the standards that have to be met. And so that's very crucial. If a company cannot meet the requirements, then the company cannot participate in that chain at all. So taken together, then, the technical infrastructure does provide an objective basis to be able to say that a company, a firm, or a country is competitive compared to other countries. Okay, so, and then now when we move on to health, as I said, that the technical infrastructure is to provide a basis for the for the protection of the consumer in terms of health needs. We see that in terms of the products that are used in the health space, blood syringes, blood pressure measurement instruments, body scales, and so forth, they also are based on measurement. So their quality is determined through the technical infrastructure. Accuracy in this case is quite important, because if the scales are not measuring correctly, the medicine that is dispensed by doctors may be too much or too little and may not do the job that it's supposed to do. Okay, moving on. In terms of safety, we see that safety at the workplace is important. So products that are approved to be worn at the workplaces also have to meet requirements. They have to meet standards, and in this case, these standards are compulsory. In terms of buildings, we do see that there are building standards that have to be met, and when they are met, the buildings that we end up with, they be big buildings like the International Convention Center there are actually very very beautiful and very safe, and the same goes for normal houses. If the standards have been followed properly, we have safe houses. In the case where sometimes people do not follow the standard, we end up with even beautiful houses falling off, like the one that's shown in that little picture, because the standard requires that the local authority have to approve that building plan, and the local authority was not consulted. So that's the result that happens. So the standard itself and the process are obviously very important. And then we see that in terms of environmental protection, we have we want our pristine environment to remain as it is, and it can stay that way without us worrying about the technical infrastructure. But however, when we have industry, we need to make sure that the pollution and other emissions from industry are controlled, are measured, so that they won't harm our environment. We also see that in terms of energy efficiency, it is important to have standards so that we can measure what we are talking about. Okay. Okay. I have more or less covered the definition and the importance of the technical infrastructure. Now, coming to our system in South Africa, I just want to show the components of the system that we have. We have the regulated sector on one in the left and the voluntary sector on the right. We see that the standards are important for both sectors, as we have already seen, and the body that is responsible for that in South Africa is the SABS, which is the South African Bureau of Standards. We have the National Metrology Institute, that is the body that's responsible for the measurement. It's at the bottom on the left. And this is the body that really, its work underpins everything that happens in the standardization area. The conformity assessment is done by various role players. You have government role players like the SABS, they do that work. But you also have private sector role players that do the testing and inspection and certification. So the requirements can be met through the standard and the conformity assessment. Be they originating from government policy and government regulators, or be they originating from the private sector. I think also what's important is that government is the one that set up the infrastructure through and through its regulation. I think what I can also say is that technical regulations that are referred to there, that is compulsory standards. So we can, when a standard is required to be met by government, that's compulsory and formal standards and a technical regulation. In terms of regulators, for the GTI, The regulator that we use is the National Regulator for Compulsory Certification, which is written there as NRCS. But however, there are other regulators in government that also use standards to do their work. Okay, moving on. We have a number of acts. We have a number of bodies, so we have a number of acts that govern what we do. We have the measurement unit and measurement standards act that covers metrology. We have legal metrology, which also covers metrology. We have standards act. We have the accreditation for conformity assessment, calibration, and good laboratory practice act that covers accreditation. Then we have the National Building Regulations and Building Standards Act that covers the building space. And then the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, which is the one that administers some of the acts, is our regulator, and it approves products that should be placed on the market. So going on to the various mandates for the various bodies, starting with the metrology, the Measurement Standards Act. The Act established NIMISA as the body that connects South African measurement system to the international system. So the NIMISA is responsible for maintaining the national measurement standards. It's the scientific body that does that. They derive the measurement units from first principles specifically, and they are also responsible for disseminating measurement to industry, measurement traceability. By traceability, we mean that there are a series of calibrations that are done from the lab, the laboratory measurement institute of South Africa, to the factory floor. Moving on, we have the Legal Metrology Act, and the Legal Metrology Act deals with protecting the consumer against short measure. So when one buys petrol, for instance, at a filling station, one wants to be assured that if you've got 20 liters, you're going to get 20 liters. So the pumping instrument there, the pumps that are used there should also be calibrated and checked in a regulator bar, and that falls under the MBS, Legal Metrology. And in that sense, then it supports the competitiveness of industry, and it levels the playing field for everyone. Okay, so just an example of measurement to just show how this works. So the question there is at the retail shop, the consumer asks, is this really a kilo? And then the explanation is that yes, it is, because in Paris, where we are also affiliated, it's a kilogram measurement, kilogram weight that is kept there, and the kilogram from the various countries is then compared to the one in Paris. So when one gets to a shop, if there's a scale at the shop, the scale should have a reading that shows that it has been approved to do the measurement. So if the scale has been approved, it has a seal that shows that it has been approved. In South Africa, that seal will be from the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. Then it means that scale can measure correctly. So if you get a kilo of tomatoes, then it will be a kilo. So that's what's being shown there. Okay, then we move on to the Standards Act, which established the South African Bureau of Standards and the standardization body to develop standards. And as I have said, the SAGS also does conformity assessment, so it does testing, inspection, and calibration. The SAGS is charged to promote quality throughout South Africa. And here we're showing technicians working in a water laboratory checking the quality of the water from TEP. And then again, this text just shows the explanation of how when we say that something is of the right quality, how that is done. Just let me explain how raw materials and products are tested to ensure your safety as a consumer. So when the raw materials come in, they are inspected. During the processing or the production process, at regular intervals, samples are taken out and then and set to make sure that everything is right. And when the final product has been made, then testing is still carried out. And then the facility itself, the factory itself, now that will have to be inspected by a government official to make sure that they keep the standards that are required. And in that sense, then the product that they sell is of the right quality and is safe for you. And then on accreditation, we have the Accreditation Act that established SANAS as the sole accreditation body in South Africa. They maintain a system that is recognized internationally. They promote the competence of laboratories in South Africa and other facilities, and they give accreditation certificates. So with accreditation, as the test shows, there is nothing to hide. Because with accreditation, we check, what it checks is that the facility will have people who are qualified to do the work that they're doing. They will have equipment that they use that is also fit for the work that they do. And they have processes and procedures in place that allow the work that they do to be reproducible. So there's nothing that will be left to change to chance if a service provider has been accredited. So,
oh, there's nothing worse than your voice going, hey, Chin.
I heard that is a thing.
Okay, and again here and with accreditation, we're just showing that when products are tested in accredited facilities, they can access a whole range of markets because accreditation, it's, there are mutual arrangements worldwide with other accreditation bodies that allow products to go to a lot of different markets without having to be retested. Okay. With the National Building Regulations and Building Standards Act, and this act is also administered by the National Regulator for Construction Certification. This act will be coming to this parliament sometime in this term. So that's why we're putting it, saying a little bit more about it. The act was promulgated in 1937, which is quite a long time. A lot has happened in South Africa since then. And there are quite a number of gaps that we need to address. So we'll be coming to Parliament for amendments, I think, in the next year or two. The Act promotes uniformity in building, uniformity in law relating to the action of buildings. It prescribes building standards and it requires that buildings be approved by local authorities prior to their being erected. And that's one area where it's quite a challenge. In some instances, residents are not going to local authorities to get their building, especially if their extension approved. And that causes a lot of problems later. It also Act requires that local authorities employ building control officers. So these are people who are knowledgeable about building and can do the inspections and can approve suitable buildings for the area. It does establish an appeal mechanism for people to appeal against decisions if local authorities do not approve what they want to do, so they have a recourse. This act is quite important, and it seems that it's not just in South Africa where an act like this is it's critical. We see here that recently in August, a house in Alberton, which was being extended, collapsed. And the reason that's being, one of the reasons that's being said caused the collapse is the fact that the owner did not go to the local authority and get permission to actually build. So it's not clear whether that structure was sound in terms of the standard requirements. Okay. The National Regulator for Compulsory Certification is the regulator that reports the Minister of Trade and Industry, and the FIS has said they approve the placement of products that we deem to be sensitive on the market, and we have a few products there that were showing the tires, cement, brake pads, and electric plugs have to be approved. Because these products have a whole lot to do with safety. So it is important that products that do not meet these standards are not sold. And in all these areas, we have had a lot of problems with products originating from other countries that did not meet the requirements. So yeah, it's quite a challenging area to try to enforce the standards there. All the bodies that are responsible for the technical infrastructure have links or are affiliated to what I'll call the mother bodies internationally. So for measuring, the National Meteorology Institute of South Africa is affiliated to the Weights and Measure System in France and the Organization for Legal Meteorology. So it's the BIPM and the OIML. They are French names, so the abbreviations are different. For accreditation, we are affiliated to AFRAG in Africa, and then the International Laboratory Association and the International Accreditation Forum. For standards, the affiliation is to the African Standard Organization, ASTO, and then to the International Standard Organization, ICANN. And then in the area of electrical products, there is also an affiliation to the African, AFSEC, African, can't get the acronym right now, and the International Electrical Commission. But basically what this shows is that there are relationship between what we do in South Africa, in the region, and internationally. Because it's important to make sure that our system is basically in line with what other people do internationally, if we want to be able to export.
Yeah, Jane just hit that acronym now. Yeah. At the top. You know, on the same diagram. The BEAT, IPM, OEME, the one we can't read, the IAS and the IEC, just check those. Not everyone has got to know what those acronyms are, and the next block.
Okay. Should I get them now?
Continue and you can, at the end of your presentation, come back to the things and do the declaration.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Moving on to the World Trade Organization. I'm not going to say a whole lot about the World Trade Organization, except that they also have an agreement that is called the Technical Barriers to Trade Agreement, the TBT Agreement, that provides for rules when it comes to using standards. The agreement promotes the use of international standards. And it has a code of practice for the preparation and adoption and implementing of standards in the economy. That's basically it on that. And then the role that we play in the department, coordination by government, we coordinate all the bodies that are responsible for the technical infrastructure. We expect the organizations to have talented, hardworking, honest employees. In terms of their business processes, we expect them to give friendly service. In terms of their financial outcomes, we expect that they will do everything at a lower cost. They'll be much more efficient, and that their remuneration level are aligned to that of the public service, and that the public result that we expect from them is that they be responsive to the need of industry, and they afford the consumer about trade protection. So yes, we expect service delivery from them. So that is the role that the department and the DTI plays in terms of strategy, steering this organization, and looking at how they are performing. This just shows the reporting structure, it's yourself, it's Parliament, the Minister, after he gets the report from the various bodies, comes to you and report back on the work that is being done. So in conclusion, the technology infrastructure is very important in our daily life, and as I have said before, we already know about it. It's really interested in the issue of definition. It provides confidence that the economy requires for all kinds of transactions that are done, and it allows South Africa and everybody else to participate in global activities.
I do not want to disturb you while you are presenting. I just understand your comment.
Okay, so the definition. I'll take them from the top because they're easier. BIPM is the Bureau of Weights and Measures.
Weights and what?
Measures. OIML.
What page is it?
25.
25, just the slide. It's the International Organization of Legal Metrology. The next one says ILAC, which is International Laboratory Association. And then after that, IIAF, International Accreditation Forum. Then ISO, International Standards Organization. IEC, International Electric Commission.
And the second row?
The second row is tricky.
Okay, if it is too difficult, we can give you an opportunity to come back with it.
Okay.
Or make it make admission to us. Okay. If you want those acronyms name.
Okay, thank you.
I think the admission will start.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kiman.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and we'll now open the floor for discussion and questions. Mr. Mkondi.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I would firstly like to welcome the presentation from Mr. Tan. This, for me, presentation tells us that I'm saying also from the previous presentation that the technical infrastructure in standards is one of the instruments to drive industrial policy or to assist in the industrial policy implementation. what I wanted to really understand is the capacity of our infrastructure and the reliability of that infrastructure. I'm asking those questions because I'm worried with many of the goods that are coming inside of South Africa and that are in the market as we speak, that do not go through this process. You know, what are those challenges and how can we close them? Because I'm looking at the success of industrialization in South Africa in years to come, that this capacity should be able to help us when we talk about the issue of the value addition, beneficiation and so forth, that we look at goods that just go out of South Africa without this particular process to undermine the industrial, I mean, project that we have. So what is the capacity and capability that we have in the infrastructure? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mkhondi. To the Mayor's first and Mr. Luyeng, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, I mean, I regard standards as so critical because, as you probably know, this gave rise to the French Revolution. Those of you who did study that. But,
take my last question.
Something like that. But the issue is so important. Through, and I think that the emphasis that these may be technical issues on the one hand, but they have to serve people to ensure that there's, you know, an equitable sharing of what it is that they are purchasing and that what they are purchasing or getting is accurate. I'm particularly concerned with the kind of work, the inspections that, you know, the SQAM is carrying out, Chairperson. Now, we could have, perhaps I missed this, and that was dealt with when I was out. But exactly, you know, we know about the health institution providing certain services, but in the first instance there, they are using instruments that have been verified here by SQAM. So if your instruments are wrong, and your process and protocol of verification is wrong, you get the kind of thing that led to deaths in the Eastern Cape, or babies, etc. These are very serious issues, or more technically speaking, the buildings that have fallen down, not only in Alberton, but where people got permission to build, and the wrong specifications and the cement. Now, where did that fall in? You know, if we could learn a bit more about this, because at the beginning of the year, you will recall, Chair, we said, I had even forgotten that buildings came under us when they came to standards, you know, and that this kind of thing. One does forget how broad the mandate is. And that, certainly, I can't speak for the Western Cape. No, just a couple of buildings have fallen down here. But when it comes to housing, when it comes to housing, we have had such an occurrence of buildings where a few lives, not one or two, but several lives were lost and not a private house. If we can get that kind of thing, and the question to me would be, when we're looking at, so the inspections is one issue, and then in relation to the rest of Africa and our trade, what is our protocol on receiving goods from other countries, including within Africa, but also internally, who gets this, or do we rely on the country of origin to have tested it and for it to come in? And if this is found to be inaccurate later on, when it arrives here and it is sold and it electrocutes someone, what recourse has our government got from a country of origin? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. This is similar to what Comrade Mkhondi was saying earlier on the status of our trading partner. Comrade Lithian, Mr. Luyeng, I'm yes. Used to calling his comrades.
Sure. Yes. No, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. I think, Chairperson, you actually covered me. Because I wanted to put emphasis on what Comrade Mkhondi was saying here. With regard to the reliability of the technical technical gurus that we have, because infrastructure is very critical. It's about life and death, What then? Is there any mode that is being used to ensure that the infrastructure that exists in the country is up to scratch? Or is there any moratorium that is being used upon the home bodies that have the responsibility to ensure that the checks and balances that are being done? At one stage, the then president nearly died in a tent where it collapsed, when there were officials who were from Pretoria to say they actually inspected and agreed that no, this infrastructure is well up to scratch. You know, you have this huge infrastructural decay that is actually not followed up, but it is being seen. What instrument that can be used, or what country that can be put upon those countries? Because when we talk about industrialization, and we are not very sure about the quality of our institutions to check if they are all reliable in order to ensure that going forward we don't get into issues like the one that happened in Nigeria. It's a fact. The ideal situation and the real situation with regards to sustenance and maintenance of our infrastructure should direct. So you are one of such groups, and you know exactly as to where do we actually go wrong. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Mr. Diman, can also tap into, do we develop such a scheme as a department? Because it is critical that we have it. When you look at the disaster that happened, in particular in mines, where people are locked inside the mines for quite some time, they lose their lives. Do you have the appetite of the department to develop such skills for continuity and don't rely on the people are aging now? Over to you.
Thanks, Chairperson. That's a question.
I was just saying that it's quite a mouthful of questions. I'll try to answer them in the order that they were asked, starting with Olki, who asked about capacity and reliability of the institutions that we currently have. Let me say that in the drive now for value addition, beneficiation, obviously we'll have to also build capacity as we beneficiate areas that we were not beneficiating previously, because this work goes hand in hand with the fact that you are actually producing the product that you need to test and inspect. So in areas where we're not manufacturing, obviously we won't have that capacity. So in developing the different areas that the department is working on industrial policy, we try to be in alignment with that sector, to make sure that we are also developing the capacity to be able to test the products that we are producing. We are very much closely aligned with the work that people in Europe do. So we have very good relationship with various laboratory or facilities in Europe, in Germany, for instance, where we can exchange personnel and people go there to do their masters and their PhD in this work. So that relationship helps quite a lot. An area where I think we struggle is the area of inspecting products that come in from various other countries. Products are supposed to come to the port with a declaration saying that this container contains products. So if a container comes and says that it has electrical plugs, for instance, then we want to see those electrical plugs. We want to test and see whether they work. Sometimes when the container comes to the port in Durban, it won't say that. It will say that it has something else, say hair extensions. Because for hair extensions, there's no tariff that has to be paid. And then the container will not be open. Because it's not, it's something that it's a safety risk is minimal, so nobody will worry about it. But actually, it's a wrong, yeah. So there's problems at the port in terms of false declarations, which also gives us a difficulty. And then we also, as the technical infrastructure, our relationship with staff is therefore very critical. The customs says, so we get the information that we need in good time, so that by the time the goods land at the seaport, then somebody is there who can do the checking. So, but that is an area that still needs improvement, the area of inspection. I'm sure you may have heard that now and then the Minister of Trade and Industry goes on campaigns to destroy products that do not meet the requirements, they do not meet our standards. But, you know, it would be nice to see those campaigns actually decreasing, because it would be showing that we are being more and more effective. So when a body like the National Regulator for Compulsory Certifications come and explain their work, I think that these are the kind of questions that we can ask them in detail in terms of the trends. Are they, with their work, is the trend of products that do not comply showing that we're winning or not? And again on what Jefferson Schwab said, the inspection work in terms of health products, in terms of cement, and so forth. We find that the products that are made here in South Africa, and I guess that's easier for the inspectors, they visit the facilities, the factories, they do the necessary checking. Those products on the whole are compliant. They are problematic. It's mostly the products that come from somewhere else that are problematic. And one other problem that comes with products from somewhere else is that once somebody gets a certificate that they can bring in products, they get a certificate that allows them to import that same product for the next 3 years. Sometimes people bring a product that is more or less a golden sample. So it's tested, it complies. But on the back of that, then they start bringing products that don't comply. And that is quite taxing to our capacity to keep following up. So yeah, that's another area that we have to be careful. We haven't had any problem with the cement that's made here. When it comes to buildings that fall, it's one of the points that the requirement is that the local authority must approve, and the local authority must then follow up and check. And so if when people are mixing cement and sand and water, if they water it down too much and the local authority is not able to follow up, then that also can be a problem. There was another question about receiving goods from other countries and whether we have a recourse. If we find that goods don't comply, as I just indicated, those goods can be returned back to that country, or they can be destroyed. So we have, in the past few 2 years or so, we have been destroying quite a bit of goods that come from the east, most of the east. In South Africa, it's not as clear as what kind of records you have. If you get a good supply by, I guess the importer will be the one who's responsible. But it's not. We don't have this liability legislation that is, gives us that clarity. Producer liability, I think, that's what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
The producer liability legislation is not. I'm not too clear on how it works in South Africa. I guess, it's something that from the court will have to decide on. But in terms of the various acts, if you contravene the act, the agency can take action. So you can bring the person who's contravening the act to the court of justice. If that's what is necessary to get that done. Then there was another question on the reliability of the infrastructure, the checks and balances. The technical infrastructure system is a risk management system. So in order to mitigate against the risk that can happen anywhere, you have to use agreed or approved standards. One of the one of the problems that we have is that of coordinating across the whole sphere of government. As I mentioned, in the area of building regulations, for instance, you have the standards, but you also have the local authority having to do the legwork of checking when a building is being regulated, that stays compliant throughout the whole process. And that is really outside the NRCS as such. So the coordination then becomes critical. We, in skills development, every agency is required now from the department to have a skills development program that they have set up. And again, this is when the agents come to Parliament, they can say a whole lot in detail about the people that they're training this year, their target, and so forth.
Any more questions?
Thank you.
The then with the week, and then the chair, of course.
No, thank you very much. I'm not interested in something. I'm not sure that I hear you very clearly. You said the hair extension program is not true. Then what do you mean and what are those extension programs? This thing, what they call, this thing that we're using, the hair of other nations to extend our hair, you call it the name for this thing. It's like a yeah. Do you mean that when you talk about hair extension products and so on? Because I've seen a challenge with this thing. And many others, they will have food and so forth. They have been challenged. Yes. So that's only true. Just clarify me on that. Thank you very much.
Wait. That's a mini simulation to X. I think as a review was done in South Africa, it was clear that Parliament and legislatures are very weak. And we are weak in relation to following up the implementation of various acts which are passed in our institutions. So my question is related to all the acts which are presented to us today. Whether the DTI is satisfied that it is implementing the acts have presented in Parliament. And the second one is in relation to local authorities, whether the DTI is going to be able really to engage municipalities in the country so that they understand the role which they are supposed to play in relation to erection of buildings, including communities. Because sometimes municipalities are very big, like a metro. And sometimes because communities don't have the knowledge and education as to what is expected from them, they don't do or report it to municipalities whenever extensions are done. Whether is there any educational program you will be having together with municipalities, maybe including Parliament. Because some of the acts which we are also passing, Chairperson, we must be able to make sure that it is understood by the communities on the ground. Because when it comes to that, fortunately, a review was done and it was showing that when we measure the negative vis-à-vis the legislatures are very weak in keeping the executive accountable. Thank you.
Can I have thank you very much, Chairperson. Just two or three points, and that is, I'm coming back to the World Trade Organization here again, because we, you know, it's indicated, now we're all belonging to the same standards of petrol, we comply with international standards and so on and so forth. And so it constantly escapes me as to when we say we comply, where does the citrus fungus issue creep in here and there? And then once it is addressed, then you have one file, what is it, one night or something, GUANTIT, it's a scientific chemical that if when used prevents the fungus, appearing, etc., and then you get that banned as well. How do these standards, you see, the standards seem to be, they don't seem to have a very long shelf life, as it were. When one does comply with those standards, then whatever it is belong to a higher shelf. Then you're forced to move into something else. So my query really, Chair, is, if we're talking about standards, just is that across the board? I imagine it is from agriculture, medical, mineral, etc. And does it require, from a WTO perspective, that all countries agree to it before it is accepted as international? Or can there be different requirements bilaterally? I hope that's quite clear. I'm particularly concerned because, Mr. McPherson and myself will be going overseas as part of another group to the WTO. This is certainly one of the issues one would have wanted to raise in that regard, but one does need that information. On the national building regs and the building standards and that sort of thing, essentially what would be helpful to all of us, we know that this piece of legislation falls under us, but yet it doesn't. With respect to building standards, regulations, etc., in many senses it's broader than that. You have the whole Health Act in terms of if someone's injured when that collapses, then a Health Act kicks in. Something else kicks in with something else. And where does the Builders Association come in here? Because like you quite rightly say, we don't have that many inspectors. They can't be there when you're mixing, etc. So I want to get a practical understanding of this before we have a real catastrophe in our country. So if we can't get it now, Chair, we can get some sort of structure or organogram, which kind of says, if DTR here, Health here, X here, how do we relate to one another? Because we have an overriding constitutional imperative of cooperative governance, you see. But just by the way, Chair, right at the beginning, one indicated that had handed out a whole sheaf of legislation. You may recall, perhaps you weren't here on the committee, and we indicated that actually we were only dealing with about, you know, 30% of what we should be dealing with when it comes to, you know, legislation that we are responsible for. So I just mentioned that, and I think we may ask the DT. I did give that to us. But members have changed on the committee. Maybe they should just give us that legislative process again when Mr. Yahan, Advocate Yahan, who is Stadham, comes to us. I know he's not coming tomorrow because he cut short the program, but when he does come, that's going to be useful, Chairperson, and I hope you agree.
Yeah, but he will probably cover the track because it's close to the action. The building space, this building standards area, is the problem with it is that it's fragmented. We have a number of departments. We have housing, trading industry, COPTA, public works. Then you also have various bodies that have been established. So all these role players have something to do, and some of them have acts that actually govern what they have to do. So it makes it very difficult to coordinate. So yeah, so I think that's one of the problems. It's just too fragmented as it is now. And in terms of all the various laws, I think what's required is, which we have also started now, is this raising awareness campaign that we have to go out to the communities and be trying to inform them. With legal metrology, for instance, the scales that are being used in the supermarket, they have a marking that shows that the scale has been approved. But most of us don't know that actually there is a mark. So they can continue to use something that has not been approved, and nobody will ever ask, which is one of the problems. So awareness seems to be quite a key activity that the government will have to do.
I would love to remind you that you still owe us an information that you have to email to the officials or the secretary of the community by tomorrow. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think I was going to overstep my mark because I wanted to meet people for lunch.
Yeah.
But I, at this point, thank very much for listening to me and being a good audience. I will hand over to the chairperson for the comments.
He actually chaired very well. Thank you, comrades. Thank you, Honourable Mantash. See, we all flip into that. But all I wanted to say is that, and it's important that we all listen because it affects all of us. Lunch is scheduled for an hour. We can have an hour, or we can have half an hour, 40 minutes. What about 35 minutes for lunch? That be a problem? No, because I don't want to just change it. We have a problem if we stop now at 20 to 2 and come back at 4:15, basically.
I'm not 100% sure which of the restaurants. I don't think Marksville is open, actually.
So I'm trying to cut lunch, you know, the timing, so that we could try and complete a little bit earlier. Would that be okay, looking at you again, Jordan? Can we come back at, say, 5:10? We stop at 4:15 sharp. Sharp, right.
Okay.
No, Mr.
Jamani.
Yep, that's right. Can we leave our stuff here?
That issue I'm standing is not as simple as an ambassador.